Support for Boston Public Radio comes from M&M Skylights, installing and servicing a wide range of commercial and residential Velux skylight products. You can find more information about their installation process and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com. And Safety Insurance, offering a variety of home insurance products to cover your home's increased value. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we have read the leaks, heard about the palace intrigue, and certainly questioned the president's motives in the White House. Now, for the first time, we're getting an insider's account of what it was like to be part of his senior staff. In his memoir, former NSA advisor John Bolton shows a leader in crisis who makes decisions with no thought, no strategy, or goal except re-election. In a couple of minutes, we'll hear more about Bolton's bombshells from Chuck Todd.
Despite already overseeing one war, President Trump gladly took on the moniker of wartime president when the coronavirus struck. Evoking memories of the glorious days of World War II, the president said we are at war with an invisible enemy. It warmed the hearts of some, but is war really the best metaphor for a public health crisis? And does it reveal America's deeper obsession with war and power? We'll talk to national security scholar Andrew Bacevich about this and more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
I can tell by Marjorie's face on Zoom, she's already on fire. We shall see.
I'm worked up. I'm in a frenzy.
If Trump doesn't want people to read John Bolton's White House tell-all, then he probably shouldn't have aroused everyone's curiosity by seeking an emergency order to block it. But it's already too late. Some of the book's most damning details, as you know, are already out, including Bolton's claim that Trump asked China's president for re-election help, and then he encouraged them to keep building concentration camps for Muslims there. Given the abuses of power Bolton claims to witness, why did he refuse to testify at Trump's impeachment inquiry? Joining us online for his take on this and other headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck, of course, is moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston's Channel 10 of most providers. Chuck is also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
And hello there.
Well, hello, Chuck Todd. So obviously John Bolton is getting some criticism for revealing all these secrets in his book instead of testifying in the impeachment hearings. But for you, Chuck Todd, what is most difficult for the president in his expose?
Well, look, the best way I can describe my feelings in the book are it confirmed a lot of my worst fears. That's like the best probably description I could come up with for how I've everything in there was shocking, and yet you're not fully surprised. The China stuff is exactly, that's how he talks. He thinks everything is a deal, everything's a quid pro quo. You got to help me out, I'll help you out. I think the China stuff's the most damning politically, simply because the Trump campaign wants to make Biden weak on China, wants to create the idea that Biden's soft on China. Well, John Bolton is now a character witness on behalf of Joe Biden on who's soft on China. So if you're saying what is probably the most damning allegation, it's that one.
But if you say most damning, Chuck Todd, here's my thesis. If you said to your producers of Meet the Press Daily, I would like you to book today all the guests who, after having read excerpts from Bolton's book, have turned on Donald Trump, I'm guessing you would have no guests on your show. Who is going to be moved by this, who is a Trump supporter, either rank-and-file voter, an opinion leader? Who didn't know, even if they didn't know the facts, who didn't know that this is who Donald Trump is?
I think in Washington, nobody, okay? And I think there's no doubt there. I think what this does, though, is it's sort of yet another log on the fire. And while I agree that, none of this has served to sort of shake his devoted base, that's not who this election's about. This election is about, the college-educated Republican, the person that does, and that's at the end of the day, that's the group that's Trump is bleeding right now. And that's where Bolton has some influence. That's the group of voters that you hear from when they say, I wish he wouldn't tweet. It's a bit exhausting. I wish he would just, you know, you listen to his advisors, or I wish he would do this. These are, so I think, you know, this is, I take your point that it isn't, look, it isn't going to change Trump. And no, there's no Republican U.S. senator that's going to come out and say, boy, that's it. You know, see, I knew it. That's true. But I think this has an impact on that slice of voter that is exhausted.
Well,
but
when,
but
when
may have voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
When Bolton really ridicules the president and says things like Vladimir Putin plays him like a fiddle and understands that Trump is not a serious contender, he's not worried about him. He talks about whether Trump is confused about whether Finland is part of Russia and whether you know, the United Kingdom has weapons and how
nuclear
apparently
weapons.
He was, yes, nuclear weapons, excuse me, and calls him, quote, stunningly uninformed. You do think that might move some people who are just worried about what a second term could be like. And the stuff about
Marjorie,
worrying about Ivanka.
Let's look at it another way. Can we look at it another way?
Yeah.
John Kelly, Jim Mattis, Rex Tillerson, and John Bolton. Do you think any of those four men are voting for Donald Trump?
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
All right. Isn't that the closing message to Republican voters that Biden wants to send? Who knows Donald Trump better than these four men? His former chief of staff, his former secretary of defense, his former secretary of state, and his former national security advisor. It's pretty, when you look at it in those terms, it's absolutely alarming. How many more warnings does the country need?
Chuck, have you read the book yet or no?
NBC has a copy. I've gotten the first 100 pages.
Okay.
I get my own hands on the book later today.
So I'm
confident in the first 100 pages, in fact, plus what I've obviously read of the excerpts.
Well, I don't have a copy of the book, and all I've read are the excerpts and the stories. I mean, one of the things, by the way, is interesting, is so Trumpian. You know, he allegedly gives the okay to the concentration camps for the Uyghurs in China, and then yesterday he files a bill pressuring China over the crackdown on the Uyghurs. It's just the day excerpts
Do you know he'd been sitting on that for 9 days?
No, I did not know actually.
He'd been sitting on that bill for 9 days. It had passed a while ago. And he'd been sitting on it. And all of a sudden, literally 20 minutes after the Bolton excerpt goes live in the Wall Street Journal, the White House puts out that press release that he signed that bill.
But where I was going to go, the last thing on the Bolton book, at least from me, is when I was reading about I was wondering about the issue that I broached in the introduction to you about how does he justify not testifying in front of Congress. And from what I've read about, he mentions it in the epilogue, the House should have slowed down. You know, all the Senate should, you know, just if the Senate had subpoenaed him, et cetera. I don't find that wildly compelling. Do you? Why didn't he testify?
I think it's a good question. It's going to haunt him for a long time. I mean, I know what he was trying to do, right? He wanted the appearance that he was being forced to do this. He didn't for whatever reason, right? Maybe he wanted to preserve his, you know, one theory has been he wanted to preserve his ability to be a Republican in good standing post-Trump. So whatever the motivation, ultimately, I think that is something that it's going to haunt him. Now, whether it actually personally haunts him, I don't know. I don't know the man well enough to say that, but it will always hang over his head, you know, just in the same way. I think John Bolton is on Comey Island. Okay. Jim Comey Island. I think Bolton has found a way to, you know, the left's never going to forgive him for not standing up when it counted. And there are going to be two parts to the right's criticism. One is going to say, if you had these things to say, why didn't you do it sooner? And another is going to say, this is pretty disloyal. Even if you didn't like it, you could have waited the last of the election. There's an unofficial protocol to tell all books. But, you know, in the Trump era, everything's out the window. So I do think Bolton will be sort of a pariah for some on both sides of the aisle a la the way Comey is sort of that figure.
By the way, did you guys see that Jeff Daniels, who I love, is playing Comey in the, I don't know if it's an HBO, a Showtime thing that's going to come out right after the election?
I saw that. I don't know how I feel about this. These quick nonfiction, turnarounds of recent events getting dramatized. I'm for historical drama that's 100 years old. I love it. Mm-hmm. I get a little like, if I lived it, I don't know if I want to watch it.
I'm a lower rent kind of guy than you, Chuck. I think that's pretty evident to the listeners, so I'm into it.
Yeah, me too. I'm right there in the low rent drawer.
I don't say low rent. I just sort of, I'll sit there and nitpick. That's my problem. Oh, my God. That is not the way it happened. It didn't go that way. But if it's 100 years old, you're like, gloss over that stuff. I want to gloss over.
So, Chuck Todd, let's talk about another really bizarre situation is the big rally going ahead in Tulsa, Oklahoma, despite the fact that coronavirus cases and hospitalizations are spiking in states around the country, including Oklahoma, Florida, Arizona. No mask required. Everybody still is going to be inside. I don't get the politics
Nor
of this.
Do
I think maybe he might have been better off that as a president going outside and still, if he wanted to have a rally and just
as the governor requested.
Yeah.
I don't know why he's insisting on seeing it. If the car can go 150 miles an hour and if he can drive it without a seatbelt, like it's sort of, they painted themselves into this corner, right? About flexing their muscle about reopening. Don't be afraid. We need a packed rally and all this stuff. And they made mistake after mistake. And in the, because of Trump's inability to ever admit mistakes, I mean, the fact that, he couldn't even claim he wanted to move the rally due to Juneteenth. He had to put it in somebody else asked him to do it. And so he moved it as a favor to them. Type of thing, right? Because he never wants to acknowledge some mistake. And I just think they keep piling unforced error. I mean, this thing now, Oklahoma, first of all, Tulsa's on a rise. It's insisting on indoors. They've made mask wearing, literally anybody that walks into that arena wearing a mask is going to be looked at like a Biden supporter.
Absolutely right.
It's just going to be, and then you have a president who right now is getting it from so many corners. This could be one of those, there's always that rally. He has a rally about once every 6 months where he just goes off, right? It's sort of the truly unhinged version of this, of Trump sometimes, right? He did it, it's the infamous SOB line was one of those, was one of those moments, right? Where he just throws the script away and it just settles. It's a score settling rally. Boy, if that has this written all over it, right? With the Bolton book, the virus back, Biden up double digits, and so you throw all of this together, never mind that you now got Oklahoma calling in the National Guard concerned about what's going to happen there. I mean, it's people that are celebrating Juneteenth, Trump supporters, it's got ugliness written all over it, and the president knows it, and they're doing it anyway. I think it comes with an enormous political risk this weekend.
I'm so glad to hear you say that because that's my take on this too. And also, when you read that these 7-day infection rate highs are happening in some Arizona, Florida, Oklahoma, that Florida could be the next epicenter. Most of these states, I was going to say ruled, run by Republican governors. You have a guy like Ducey out there in Arizona who was against masks. Now he's for masks. It seems to me as the walls start to close and people, the numbers escalate, Chuck Todd, that this whole total BS that it's only because we're doing more testing that there are more cases, which is the Trumpian, Pencean argument, dissipates, and he is faced with something that he has no ability to control the message on. Don't you think?
I think so. And for what? Nobody, he'd get nothing but praise for having caution about an indoor rally.
Great point.
Nobody would. Number one. And more importantly, you're doing all this for Oklahoma? I mean, you don't need to, I would at least understand if this were Michigan and he'd be like, I really want to have a show of force. You're like, there's a political motivation. You're expending a lot of political capital for Tulsa, and you may have only done yourself harm. I mean, you have put Republican allies of yours in horrible positions. Lankford, Stitt, the governor, who have all desperately tried. You can tell they're trying not to offend the president publicly. Mm-hmm. They don't want to feel his wrath, but they're clearly trying to steer him out of this. And he just will not read the room, right? Like, talk about a guy that just doesn't read nonverbal cues and you know, doesn't know how to read a room. He is not reading the room here. These are all – Tulsa's got a – I mean, Tulsa's a fairly bipartisan city for a city. It's got plenty of Republicans. It's a real – all he's doing is increasing risk. I think there's an enormous – political downside here, and I don't see the upside. So they're going to gather a bunch of data. You've got plenty of data on your supporters. They're the same people that come to every rally.
You know, Chuck Todd, I mean, we are still a ways away from the election, and you never know what's going to happen. But right now, there are some polls that look very good for Joe Biden. So I'm wondering, we used to say, well, when the poll numbers begin to change, there may be some Republicans with some courage. There may be, you know, the military. There seems to be a military revolt against the president. We got this John Bolton book. Do you see any standing up to him from Mitch McConnell or anybody else?
I talked with a strategist that's involved in a couple of these on the Republican side of the aisle. Who's advising two of these very vulnerable Republican incumbents. One of whom is no fan of Trump at all, and has, if politically could find a path to victory by publicly separating, would have already done it. And it just becomes a numbers game. There's Trump's base is too big, and you will not get rewarded by Democratic voters who have already made the decision to fire you, right? So you end up losing more than you gain. You may gain overall popularity. Ask Jeff Flake. He's more popular in Arizona overall with independents and Democrats. But he was so unpopular with Republicans, and those same people who may like him weren't going to vote for him. And that's the problem you would run into, whether you're Susan Collins, whether you're Tom Tillis, whether you're Cory Gardner or Martha McSally, is that the Trump base is too meaningful to your raw vote total, that there's not a path without it. It only would make sense if you were, say, Scott Brown in Massachusetts in 2012,
yeah.
Right? Like that
yeah.
sort of scenario, or, you know, the reverse, right? Like, you know, a Doug Jones, right? Who, if Trump were a more normal Republican, right? The way Manchin flirted at times, right? Only in that situation where you feel like there's too many votes to be had on the other side not to ignore it. So it just, the numbers don't work. I mean, that's what Trump has remade a Republican Party, and these non-Trumpy Republicans don't have a big enough base to counter it.
Hey, Chuck, 1 minute before you go, I know you had Tim Scott on, who obviously is the point person on mm-hmm. the criminal justice, the police reform thing in the Senate. You had him on Sunday. I know that, I don't know if I'm reading too much into this thing, but Marjorie bringing up McConnell made me think of this. He said 2 days ago, we're not going to take up this bill till after July 4th. Mm-hmm. And then yesterday, mm-hmm. the day before, he said, we're going to do it next week. That seems to me that the Republicans of the Senate know they really got to do something, and maybe something even serious, maybe go further mm-hmm. than the Tim Scott bill. Am I reading that right or no?
There is a lot of that. And look, I had a Republican chief of staff say to me, don't discount Breonna Taylor in Louisville as having had some impact on McConnell.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
And saying that, look, I'm not going to, you know, the person said to me, like, I'm not going to sit here and say it, that, but McConnell has not treated this as much as a political tactic the way he normally does, you know, as, hey, we can jam the Democrats. I mean, now, he may have just jammed the Democrats here a little bit, right? By moving faster, he's basically forcing Democrats to make a decision, right? Which is, do you guys want to try to work on a path together first?
Mm, I got it.
And if it fails, fine, it fails. But do you want to try that? Or but risk that you may not like what the result is? Or do you say to Democrats, okay, if you don't want to go down this path, do you want to risk looking like you're shutting down this debate in the Senate, right? Which is what the position that Senate Democrats are in. I have to say I'm more pessimistic today than I was 2 days ago. Mm. And simply, if you look at all the drama yesterday, you know, if you told me that Karen Bass and Tim Scott were going to start hammering out a deal, I'd say we're going to get a deal. I think Karen Bass and Tim Scott are close. Okay. She's handling the bill on the House Democrats. I interviewed her earlier this week, and she was nothing but, hey, I'm really glad that their goals are the same. Now I think there should be more meat on the bone, right? They doesn't have enough teeth, you know, but they were philosophically headed in the right direction. Yesterday, you saw a lot of people looking for reasons to be offended, which is always a sign of, this thing may be going down a partisan road. So I'm slightly pessimistic because I do think leadership is suddenly thinking about November,
which is not that far away. Chuck, great to talk to you as always. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys.
See you.
Hang in there.
Enjoy the Bolton Book Club.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Chuck Todd. See you later. Chuck Todd is moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News.
Neil, before we break, Marjorie, just one thing I was disappointed by. I think I'm right about this. I checked on Audible last night to see if Bolton read the book, because I was figuring if you want to get the full impact, you don't just get the book. I can't believe I'm buying John Bolton's book. But to hear him, but I don't think he's the narrator of his own book, which is really, really unfortunate.
Okay. Up next, we're going to open the lines and ask you, with coronavirus cases rising and hospitalizations rising in much of the South and West of the United States, are you a little concerned about a second wave? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
What's possible? Northeastern.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Mark Regan and Jim Brody. Is President Trump aspiring to be the first super spreader in chief? This Saturday, to the horror of many public health officials, 20,000 of his supporters, actually maybe more, in an overflow crowd, including the vice president, by the way, will crowd into an indoor arena. They'll be bellowing their enthusiasm for the president, projecting their droplets across the stadium along the way. You know, while the Northeast, places listening to the show, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, seem to have coronavirus in check, are you worried it's a short-term defeat as cases rise in other parts of the country and Trump continues to flagrantly mock the threat of the coronavirus? The number is 877-301-8970. Put another way, at a certain point, are we only as safe as other states are? With cases surging in the South and West and Trump refusing to entertain the notion of another shutdown, forget shutdown, even refusing to entertain the notion of minimal personal protection, are you worried we'll see the curve rise again? I am. 877-301-8970. And Marjorie, just before we started the show, I looked up the latest. 10 states are currently experiencing their highest 7-day average infection rate. Florida, where the Republican convention is going to be. Arizona, Texas, Oklahoma, where the president and vice president will be on Saturday. It's not all Republican-led states. California with Gavin Newsom, which did very well early on, is having a really hard time now. And, you know, it isn't like there's some virus wall in between Florida or Texas or Arizona and Massachusetts. And I have to say, the lack of concern by the feds, and in many of these cases, a lack of concern by the people who run these states, not in all of them, but in some of them, worries me that it's only a matter of time, despite how we've listened to the bakers of the world, that it's coming back for us. Is that paranoia?
Well, I think it's almost like we're at a new phase now where some people are deciding, okay, well, except for Arizona, where they're seeming to have a problem with the hospitals being overrun. we're going to take some risk, and we're going to get out. But the problem with taking too much risk is that the reason you want to get out is to restart the economy. And needless to say, if people are afraid of going to restaurants, of going to bars, because we see these spikes go on, it's going to hurt the economy. So, you know, the public health people that said, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't, you know, rush out because you want to say, okay, let's get the economy going and then risk everybody getting sick. It would just put us back to square one.
But you can. I mean, a lot of public health people have shown sensitivity to the economic pain and the pent-up desire to get out in the world, particularly as summer comes. And the answer is wear a mask and social distance. It's better to stay in your house, but I'm feeling the same way. I want to go out too, but that's not what we've been experiencing in most, not all of these states, most of these states. Again, Florida just bid for the Republican convention because the governor of North Carolina would not promise Donald Trump they could have as many people packed into a convention hall as the Republican Party wanted. So he said, come on down to Jacksonville. They are, if you read the stories this morning, which I assume most of our listeners have done, the most public health experts are saying the next epicenter of this virus is Florida. Come on down, Republicans. I mean, really? So I have to say, and I think this is the culmination of this. I know I've said it every day, so I got to get it out of my system. Saturday is going to be one of the most depressing moments in recent American history, because I'm telling you, maybe I'll be wrong, I am telling you, I think Chuck said this a couple of minutes ago, that even if they hand out masks at the door on the way in, the way you show your the thing Chuck said is you put a mask on when you go into the thing, you must be a Biden supporter. And that's what the notion is going to be. You want to show you love your president, you support your president, then take your mask off because he's not wearing one either. 877-301-8970.
And you know what I don't understand either? What's that? A business that is really been hurting from no fault of your own, your restaurant, your retail, your small bit, whatever you are, why you wouldn't say to people, wear a mask, because the chances of something going bad in your business establishment are increased exponentially by not wearing a mask. I don't get that either. Why people would let their customers into their own place and take that risk. I don't know.
But in any case, I'm nervous about the whole thing, I have to say. 877-301-8970. I'm nervous that Fauci hasn't spoken to the president in more than 2 weeks. I'm nervous that we haven't had a press availability from the Coronavirus Task Force of the White House since, I think, April 27th. I mean, it's really an S show. It really is. It's really a disaster. Maybe I'm overreacting, and maybe it's no big deal. We shall see. Let's go to Tom. Are you in Michigan calling from Tom? Is that right? Hi.
Hi, guys. Hi. Yeah, I am. I just relocated about a year ago from New Hampshire. And
welcome.
I listen to you guys streaming, and I've called in a few times before.
Great.
But, you know, part of what's happening here is my children still live with my ex-wife in New Hampshire. I haven't seen them in about 4 months, 5 months. Mm.
Oh.
And I want to get them out here for the summer. But, you know, with this second wave, I'm here as my mother's primary caregiver.
Oh, you told us, right. Yeah.
I have a compromised immune system. She's elderly. She's 85. She has a compromised system. So, you know, with all of the reports of what's going on, I'm concerned about them flying because I have no idea who they'll be on that plane with. And, you know, the other option is to drive to go pick them up and bring them back, which is 16 hours. But is it safe to stay in a hotel?
Well, let me tell you, for whatever it's worth, this will shock you, that Marjorie and I are not public health experts. So the last kind of thing I'd like to give, I mean, you hear the guys who run the airlines, and they are guys who run the airlines, saying we circulate the air better than everybody else. Most airlines have a space. The middle seat is unoccupied. Not all of them. Most of them
have a middle seat.
What's that?
I have one of my best friends just flew from California. Every place was taken.
Every seat was taken?
From California to here.
But, you know, Tom, the offer I can make you, I'm assuming next week we will have a public health doctor back on the show taking questions. And so if you can't find somebody in the interim, we'll try to provide a public service to you
No, and I
down the line.
I mean, I appreciate that. So where I am right now, we only have 12 reported cases in Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And
where are you in
Michigan?
We
don't have any deaths.
Where are you?
It's Northport. It's uh-huh. It's in Northport. It's okay. It's just north of Traverse City. So we're in the lower peninsula, great area. And, you know, I actually support what, you know, Governor Whitmer has done. And I think she's helped out tremendously with really hard choices. But she has made our safe, I think, quite safe. And a lot of people are saying that we're coming out of it in a smarter way than most people.
Well, obviously you don't know what you're talking about because the president has said she is totally incompetent. So that must be.
I know.
Tom, good luck to you and your mother
I
and
drive.
Your kids. And again, tune in next week. I can't promise you, but I'm pretty certain we'll have somebody with expertise to address your very important question.
I think that's one of the problems is that
when
you're going to fly somewhere and you expect they're going to be it open, you expect they're not going to crowd the plane, then you get on the plane and you find that's not true, you're kind of stuck. I would drive. At least you know what's going on in your own car.
Are you being hyperbolic, by the way, about every seat, or to make a point, literally every seat on the plane from California?
No, I'm not. I am not. She was beside herself, and she called the airlines, and she complained, and she was beside herself over it. And but by the time you realize that every seat is taken, it's kind of a little late to stage.
Well, I think
protest.
The solution, not that they'll be straight with you, I think the answer is when you're booking a flight, you call up the airline, you wait on hold for 7 hours, and then you ask them a question about whether or not they are one of the airlines that guarantees that the middle seat. It still makes me nervous to fly, but I have to say, if they make you wear a mask and there's a middle seat that's unoccupied, that is, to me, a pretty decent safeguard if you got to travel. And Tom from Michigan hasn't seen his kids in 4 months. And so I'm not suggesting you take unnecessary
Horrible.
Risks.
That's
but it's
one
that's tough.
Of the saddest things about this is families that are separated, parents from their children and grandparents, and particularly in divorce cases where kids live in a different state. Let's go to Matthew from Haverhill. Thank you for calling, Matthew.
Hey, Matthew.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie.
Hey.
So my main point was basically I think these places out west and even parts of the south, I don't even think they've seen a first wave, in all honesty. When me and my friends talk about coronavirus, I mean, we look at the 1917 flu and we look at these other pandemics that we've had, and we basically say, you know, a second wave is inevitable, but I think some of these places haven't even had a first.
I think you're right. I think you're right. But however, there was in some of the places where they did have at least a piece of a first wave, there was a lot of this isn't like, what's that called when you, hindsight being 2020, I hate that expression, I don't know why I used it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
A lot of these governors were criticized by a lot of the governors in the 10 that I'm talking about, like Abbott, for example, mm-hmm. in Texas is a good example, DeSantis in Florida, about being far too careless in the speed of their opening. So even if they didn't have a New York City kind of, you know, epicenter thing, obviously nobody did like New York City, they at least, there were warnings that they were too enamored of a quick opening. But whatever it is a first wave, as a lot of experts said. This, you know, this is not a second wave. It's even if it's an extension of the first, it is a first. But the problem is, you know, I didn't say this, but on that list, if you read where the president says he plans to have rallies in the next month, almost every site of a rally, with the one exception I can think of is Michigan, actually, speaking of Tom from Michigan, these are the states where he plans to go because these are states that he should have won that is now a close race. So it's nerve-wracking. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Margaret emailed concerned about Massachusetts Republicans attending the Republican National Convention. They'll bring all the COVID back to the Bay State here. It's interesting what's going to happen. She wants to know what Governor Baker's going to do about that. She wants him to convince the Republicans to watch it online.
Can I tell you something?
You know, that is.
You and I have been to a lot of conventions. And I've never been to a
convention. Oh, my God.
You and I have never been to a convention as a delegate. I've only been as whatever I am. You know, I don't know what I do. But whatever it is I do in my professional capacity. But not only are they packed, as you say, well beyond
packed.
The size of the crowds, They're huge fun, even as an observer. And I can imagine there are a lot of candidates I've loved. and the thrill of being in the presence when all that excitement builds. Having said that, we're not going to the conventions this summer, including the one that's going to be in person, not because we're not interested in what happens at the Republican convention, but because we're sane. I mean, what kind of person who's going to come home to other people in their house or their community is going to go spend 5 days in a room with 25 drinking, shouting, yelling, as you say, yep, cheek to gal, delegates? I don't think so.
Well, you know, and to get a sense of it, I remember going out to the Denver convention when Barack, in the Democratic convention, when Barack Obama was the nominee. Yep. I remember I was working for the Herald then, and as usual, we didn't have a seat, so I was running around trying to find a seat, and I was ejected from the press room, and I'm stuck on the escalator because there's so many people on the escalator and there's so many people in the elevator. I mean, it's a total, complete mob scene, and I must have run around for 20 minutes before I found myself a place to sit, because every seat is taken. It's just like a Super Bowl game. I've never been to a Super Bowl game, but I imagine it's like that. Everything is packed, the bathrooms, the escalators. It's just crazy.
And by the way, and obviously, if you're there, not as a reporter, but if you're there as a delegate, you're there because it's very likely that you are totally infatuated with the man, for the most part, with, I guess, one exception 3 years ago, who's going to be on the stage in a couple of days. So that even increases the intensity and the excitement. And it's a really dangerous proposition. But the first dangerous proposition is Saturday in Tulsa.
Else?
And as I said yesterday, let me just finish one thing about Saturday. Generally, Trump's rallies have more older people than younger people. And to the credit of Senator Lankford from Oklahoma, who thinks it's perfectly fine, this is happening, was on CNN last night. And to his credit, while he supports the president and vice president going, he did say, Marjorie, that he thought if you're older, over 60, 65, whatever, he'd urge you to stay home. I thought that was at least something in the right direction. What were you going to say there?
Never mind. Luke on Cape Cod. Thanks for calling, Luke.
Hey, Luke.
Hey, how you doing, Jim and Marjorie? First time
Thanks.
Caller.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a registered nurse. And,
I didn't hear that. Say it again. You're what?
I'm a registered nurse, and okay. I worked the H1N1 pandemic. But what I'm really calling is that I just drove my family across country to Arizona and had some stories about that. And then I flew back, and Marjorie's right, 100% filled.
Oh, my gosh.
And if you had a Texas Lone Star on your shirt, you were not very good about wearing that mask, that's for sure, on my way back.
Really?
And the other thing that was very interesting, if you went to Home Depot, nobody wearing masks.
Oh,
not the staff, nobody. You go to Lowe's, everybody. Well, about 70% of the customers and 100% of the staff were wearing masks.
What is that about?
Now,
it's about the Home Depot guy's a huge supporter of Trump.
Oh, my
right?
God.
The guy that owns Home Depot? Big Trump guy?
Yeah, I think
hey,
that's
Luke,
the whole show. It was, yeah.
May I ask you a question? When you were driving cross country and you stopped on the highway or wherever, were there any problems using bathrooms or were there problems with hotels?
So the hotel thing seemed like it was because they were basically unoccupied. We felt pretty confident in the hotel situation.
Yep.
Starting with two kids, teens. We're pretty engaged because I'm a nurse. Obviously, I'm pretty engaged with the whole show. So they took it upon themselves to basically show everybody how to wear a mask properly. But we went to several rest stops. And I tell you, if you go to Oklahoma, there is nobody wearing a mask in Oklahoma. They will all go to that Trump rally. None of them will be wearing a mask. I can tell you that almost for certain. And they looked at us and kind of hummed and hawed. And you can see you hear some laughing and giggling. There were many places that we stopped where people were serving ice cream, reaching over those ice cream bins, scooping it out, and there was no mask. And we just turned around and said, "No, my kids wouldn't even go in there." Like, I'm not eating from there.
You know, Luke, before you go, the one heartening sign, at least in your travels, Arizona. Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong here. Isn't Arizona the place where the governor who opposed a mandatory mask thing a couple of days ago did a flip? And said,
yeah,
because it's so
hospitals
out of, yeah,
are overflowing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a little late in the game, but I'm sorry, Luke, go ahead.
No, I have two friends that actually work in Arizona, one as a nurse practitioner and another one as an ER physician. They basically told me what we were talking about here, 3 months ago. Don't get sick. Stay home. Yeah. Be careful because there's just no room in the hospitals anymore. It's a disaster.
Luke, thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970. What?
You know, you must just believe it is a hoax, because otherwise you might be scared, particularly if you had some disease or you were older or you were some other way compromised. Wouldn't you think?
Well, maybe. But, you know, I've said this a lot of times, so let me bore even myself by saying it. I think when you see the protesters, admittedly, most of them wearing masks, but still out there in huge numbers, when you see the president and the vice president at a diner 2 days ago, the vice president was on Iowa, the president doing his law enforcement thing the other day, the average person who isn't, you know, spending their time boning up on public health may think we've gotten through this. We've gotten through this for the most part. And places are reopening, and I trust the governor. I voted for him, whoever that governor is. And he or she wouldn't let these things up. So I don't know if you have to believe it's a hoax. People feel cooped up and maybe feel it's time. Having said that, to me, it's very, very dangerous. Don't you love that Fauci was asked if he'd go to the rally in Tulsa? And he said, of course not.
So.
Now, he did couch it by saying, because of his age, I think he's 79, even though he looks fabulous, by the way.
He does.
In the endangered age group kind of thing. But he didn't mince words and said he would not go, of course.
Okay, we're talking about the coronavirus, asking you if you're worried about the surge in other parts of the country. Will the progress we've made be undone here in the Northeast? Our number is 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Mardrigue, and I'm Jim Brody. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the coronavirus, asking you if you worry we'll get a second wave here in New England, where we're doing a pretty good job, it appears, to control this thing, now that Trump and Pence appear to be in full denial about the pandemic as cases surge across the South and West. 877-301-8970. You know, speaking about irresponsibility, Marjorie, which is what we're doing, I've totally forgot. You told me yesterday that because you had gone to a protest, you were going to get a test. Did you get it?
Oh, yeah, we're supposed to. Baker said, if you went to a protest, you're supposed to go out. Well, I went. I must say it was totally organized. I went to the Mass General downtown and on Nashua Street. They're adjunct there on Nashua Street. Mm-hmm. And you get in with a sticker and you put it in your dashboard and you get free parking and they tell you where to go. And then you walk in with your sticker. Everybody's in a space suit. You feel like you're at NASA. And they have this big, huge plexiglass thing that looks like an oversized phone booth with no phone in it. And on either side are these rubber arms sticking out and rubber gloves at the end. And when you get your test, this woman in my case puts her hands in the and I waited like 5 minutes. You have an appointment. Puts her hands in the rubber arms and then in the rubber gloves, and unfortunately sticks this thing in both of your nostrils.
It's unpleasant, right? Yeah.
It is unpleasant, but it's not a big deal.
So did you get your results yet or no?
No, I forgot to ask them when I find out. But all I can say, Jim, if I've got it, you're in big trouble.
I'm in Cambridge. You're in Brookline. Let me just say, Marjorie did not get a special deal, if people are thinking. Governor Baker said a couple of days ago, if you call your doctor or you go online and you were at a protest on Wednesday and Thursday, virtually everybody can get a test. And so you went through the same channels everybody else is going through, correct?
Yeah. Well, I called my doctor, but you can go to CVS or there's all these sites. There's Cambridge Health Alliance has some in Cambridge. Somerville does. There's sites all over Boston. So you can go to those sites. You just make an appointment at those sites.
It's on the mass.gov site. I think it's /get-tested. Could somebody in Brighton correct me if I'm wrong, please? But I think it's /get-tested. Regardless, it's on the mass.gov/COVID-19.
Free parking. Point that out.
Doesn't even matter where you're gone if you get free parking.
You get a little card. You get a little card. They give you a little card.
Doesn't
and
get
you
much
put the
better.
Card through on the way out. And it's like, what a wonderful thing. Dan in the car, thank you for calling.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you.
So it's good to finally get a hold of you guys. Great. Hey, Jim, I agree with you. I am really concerned about getting a second wave here. I work at a casino in Massachusetts, and we're supposed to open in phase three. I've been out of work. The people that work for me, we've been out of work since March. And I got to tell you, this stable genius that we have as a leader in the country, he is so way over his head. He just doesn't get it.
Hey, Dan, you work in a place, I don't need to tell you, but Marjorie and I went on opening day to the casino in Everett. And I know it was day one, but I mean, talk about crowded and cheek to jowl, to use Marjorie's expression. Are you or the people who work for you nervous about going back? I know you want to work, but nervous about it?
I can only speak for myself, to be honest. I'm nervous about going back. Uh-huh. I mean, we don't deal directly with the guests, but I mean, we work on the, I mean, we have to go on the floor of the casino and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I'm nervous because the thing that makes me worried is what if we have a patron that comes in that's not wearing a face mask? What if a security guard doesn't catch that? That's the thing I'm concerned about. And then another thing, I'm part of management, so I have people that work for me. What if we have people that come in to work and they're afraid to call out? You know, and they come in and they're sick too, you know?
Well, hopefully, maybe this is naive of me, so feel free to tell me I'm a fool. I'm hoping your employer, even if it's for self-preservation purposes, is savvy enough to know that they better take all precautions, because if they have an interruption there, they're going to get shut down again.
Oh, sure.
So I'm hoping they
exactly.
Hey, Dan, once you open up and go back, give us a buzz and let us know how you're feeling and how they're operating the place. Will you do that?
Oh, we'll do. We'll do.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. And by the way, the people in Brighton delivered. The site is mass.gov/get-tested. Today is the last day, and they're free. I don't know if there are any availabilities, but there are 50-plus pop-up sites around the state. The governor announced a couple of days ago. If you were to protest, you can be asymptomatic. You don't need nothing except to call. Well, I don't even know if you need an appointment everywhere, but if you go on that site, they'll tell you where you need an appointment, where you don't.
You know what else I got?
What?
A free mask.
You did, really?
Got a free mask, better than any of the masks I have, yeah.
Very official. Give you a lollipop, too, or what?
They didn't give me
it's the happiest you've been like a month.
I think I should get one of those stickers. I'm COVIDed or something like that.
Can I tell you something? I know a lot of people. You know a lot of people. I would say I don't know one person who would go to get tested who would leave without knowing how and when they get the results. Isn't that what a normal person says? Thank you very much for helping me.
I know.
And can I ask you a question before I leave? You in the space suit. Sure you can, Ms. Egan.
I was so excited about the free parking.
And they'd
Jim,
say to
I
you,
forgot.
One, when do I get my results? And two, do you think Jim talks too much on the show? And they would answer both questions. And then you could just, let's take another call.
Okay, let's go to Scott in Florida. Oh, boy, you're at one of the hot spots, Florida.
Unfortunately.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, actually, I came down here from Cambridge back in early February, just before things started happening. And
why?
I've been here throughout.
Why?
Well, I wanted to get away from Boston.
Okay.
And there were very cheap flights down here.
Okay,
so I was not, I wasn't trying to escape anything virus related.
Okay.
And had no idea.
How nervous are you now? What I said before, I wasn't trying to be rhetorical. Everything I read this morning says the likely next great epicenter of the virus is the state you're in. How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, I have to say this week, partially because I think down here the news is doing a better job covering things finally and putting the governor's feet to the fire. But in the over 3 months that I've been here, I'm more nervous now than I've ever been. I was in Miami Beach when they shut everything down there back in late March,
mm-hmm.
which was much too late. And they did that in a panic. And I remember how that felt. And this feels kind of like that what worries me most here is that as they've already reopened so many things, as a lot of people have speculated, it's going to be very hard to get people to go back to accepting another shutdown, which is becoming more and more necessary, it seems.
Well, the ultimate truism is it's a lot easier to stay closed longer, like Massachusetts did, than to reopen and have
Absolutely.
To close a second time. Hey, Scott, you know, we've all seen the photographs from here of when the beaches opened, of everybody on the beaches too close together with no mask. Is the average person getting religion now? Meaning, is the average person in Florida wearing a mask, taking seriously the public health?
That's what really worries me about this is, you know, I think that they had more of that. Yeah, there were an awful lot of people down here who never really got it in the first place. The only reason they were wearing a mask was because you couldn't go into a store without a mask.
I see.
A lot of them either didn't accept it, they were just going along because they wouldn't be able to go shopping otherwise, or they just really don't get it because an awful lot of people down here tell me they don't really follow the news, even in a time like this. And so you see a lot of those people taking public transportation. And I don't have a car here, so I have to take the bus if I do, but I rarely do. But you meet people like that, and they're in the most dangerous situation.
Well, you know, one of the other scariest things before you let us go is what Marjorie said before. Florida has one of the oldest populations in the United States, sort of a la Cape Cod, which makes it even a more dangerous situation as this thing roars its whatever there in Florida. Stay well, and you know, good luck to you. Talk about bad timing going in February, but I'd be petrified if I were in Florida right now. You know, does the I should have asked Scott. Does DeSantis? I've seen him in a lot of the governor. Does he wear a mask? I don't even know.
But I know one of his workers there was fired because they wanted her to fix the numbers and say there were fewer people.
Oh, I forgot that. That's right. That's right. Yeah, early on, yeah.
She was fired, and I guess she's gone out and done a recalculation on her own and maintains, I have not investigated this myself, but maintains that she was forced to lie about the numbers of cases to make them look better. Anyway.
By the way, Arjun, our colleague back in Brighton, says Governor DeSantis has been out in public with a mask on, so good for him. A little late to the fair in terms of precautions, but at least he's doing it, so good for him.
Okay, coming up, we're going to speak with former Sheriff of Suffolk County, Andrea Cabral, for her take on Governor Baker's proposals for police reform, and a shocking story in the Boston Globe about the salaries of police officers, including least some who have been reprimanded repeatedly for malfeasance. Andrea Cabral is next for that and more on this week's edition of Law and Order. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Donald Trump may not like being president anymore, but he loves playing one on TV. After months of inaction on the coronavirus, the president dubbed himself a wartime leader and pledged to fight the invisible enemy that is the virus. But it's not a war. It's a public health fiasco. And it's not the first time a president has done this. There's a war on drugs, a war on poverty, even a culture war out there. It leaves one wondering if Americans are simply obsessed with the concept of war. That's what national security historian and former Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich thinks. He'll join us in a few minutes to tell us why.
Rick Steves has dedicated his career to showing Americans and others what he loves about Europe. Today, though, he's concerned that America might be a little too similar to Europe. Europe circa 1936, that is. In a documentary produced by Steves, inspired by the ascension of Donald Trump, Steves looks at the story of fascism in Europe, coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Did you hear Henry just say Cafe Pamplona in Harvard Square 60 years is shutting down?
I know. It's horrible.
I mean, it really is horrible. In any case, joining us online for another edition of Law & Order is Andrea Cabral, former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety, and now the CEO of Ascend. Hello, Andrea.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Andrea Cabral. So, we have all been talking about the police officers and defunding police and reprioritizing police. The Boston Globe's Matt Rochelot and Dugan Arnett have a pretty shocking story on the front page today of the Globe. talking about the payroll surging in Boston, going up dramatically, 43% since 2011, overtime going up 84%. And they not only talk about the fact that more than two dozen officers earn over $300,000 a year, but the lead officer they're talking about that earns over $300,000 a year was fired by Ed Davis for misrepresenting overtime, et cetera, back in 2007. So I'm dying to know, as somebody who spent her life in law enforcement, what you make of the story. And by the way, I went through the names, the people making $300,000, the people making $200,000. I don't think I saw a single woman. Maybe I missed a woman, but I was interested in that too. But what do you make of the story?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the exact, you know, fact pattern of what transpired between the termination and that
unclear. They don't know either.
The job.
They don't know yet.
But how it generally works is that the termination was challenged at arbitration.
Yep.
One of two things could have happened there. There could actually be a decision by an arbitrator, which I would assume would be public record, but maybe not, overturning the termination, which is why the officer is still on the job, or if there was some indication that that was going to be the arbitrator's decision, the department may have pulled back on the termination for whatever reasons they may have had. But in any event, what's clear is that, you know, the work action that former Commissioner Davis announced is not actually what happened.
You know, can I clarify something? No, I want to clarify one thing you both
what?
Said. It's my reading of this thing. This may be a small point. Is the line in their story is that, and in a press release announcing Kervin, that's this lieutenant's impending firing, then
yep.
Commissioner Davis says so and so. That seems suggests to me that it maybe is not that he was fired and got his job back. It's maybe that there was an impending firing and it never happened. Not that may be a small detail, but I'm not 100% clear if he was canned.
Well,
I am clear that Davis did say, based upon the nature of this case, termination was an appropriate response. I'm sorry, Marjorie, go ahead.
Yeah, well, we talked about this with the commissioner that followed Davis, Bill Evans, who said that happened to him on more than once, and it might have been many times, that he fired officers for malfeasance, and they were reinstated, that there were police officers who didn't think should be in the force or on the force. But the reason I'm so shocked by this, I guess, is, you know, we were talking earlier this spring about how there isn't toilet paper and functioning sinks and dirty water in school buildings all over Boston. And it's unconscionable to me that police officers are making this kind of money, and they have things written into their contracts that you get a detail, and the detail may take you 15 minutes, but you got to get paid for 4 hours anyway. I don't know. I mean, maybe you're friendly with a lot of cops. I don't know, Andrea, but I think taxpayers must be pretty stunned by this. When we have housing issues, you can't build enough housing, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm friendly with a lot of cops. It doesn't change my view of whether or not the salaries that people are allowed to take down are excessive. If you look at the chart in the Globe story that breaks down by category, the percentage of a certain group of employees and what percentage their base pay represents versus overtime versus other, you see that the Boston Police, their base pay represents the lowest percentage of what
right.
they make, which means that overtime and other make up a significantly greater portion of what they make versus, you know, fire department employees, Boston Education employees, or other City of Boston employees. And that's the fundamental problem. I mean, I don't, you know, on the issue of the details, police details that you were talking about, I don't know whether or not you're paid for 4 hours for 15 minutes, but I do know that that's the rate for court time. So, you know, when I first started as a prosecutor and throughout the entire time I was a prosecutor, it was always a provision that I absolutely thought was insane, which is if a police officer is signed in as a court day, the defendant could fail to appear and could default at the first call of the list. most judges will put it over until a second call, but that's really only going to take you to another hour or so in most courts, maybe a little bit longer. But the idea that a defendant could be defaulted early and the officer is only in court for 15 or 20 minutes or maybe an hour and gets paid for 4 hours is completely inexplicable. But that is – when I talked about last week about provisions that are built into a contract, especially in years where whatever the amount of salary increase can't be had because the money just isn't there, these are the kinds of provisions that get built into a contract that – then become cemented in over time, and they're permanent. So even when times are better and the rates of salary increase that people seek are granted, they still have these other things to fall back on. So it's in addition to.
You know, there are two issues really in this story. One is that so many people make, what, 2.5 times what the mayor makes or 2 times what the mayor makes. But there's also the issue about the disciplinary process. And we talked on the show, I don't know if we did it with you, Andrea, or not, but I know we talked after the Globe editorial a couple of weeks ago when they said the legislature should consider a statutory change which precludes police unions from negotiating disciplinary procedures. And by the way, I'm a big due process guy. I don't think they should take everything off the table, but in terms of your right to negotiate some basic due process things. But when you read about a guy who's supposed to be fired and was legitimate, and Marjorie's told the stories repeatedly about cops who have done some pretty horrible things, including people like Bill Evans. And
he
was fired. Oh,
it
does. I'm sorry. My apologies. Getting their jobs back. I asked Marty Walsh last night. He was on Greater Boston with me. If he would take the lead, obviously he's a union guy for much of his life, on a conversation about limiting, not eliminating, limiting police unions' negotiating power around discipline. Here's what the mayor had to say.
Leave that conversation to the legislature to decide, having conversations with us on what to do and how we move forward here. I think that becomes a slippery slope as far as taking people's rights away, as far as organizing. I do think, though, that we have to have more open dialogue with the police unions about how we advance our police department moving forward. As a former president of the union, I was there to advocate on behalf of the members. Of the union that I was president of. And when I ran the building trades, the same thing. But I also think that when there's opportunity for reform, you have to take it.
By the way, we swallowed, unfortunately, my fault. First few words, it was unclear. He said in response to my question, no, I'm not, I'm going to leave that conversation to the legislature, that he would not take a leave. That's, I assume, and again, you talk all the time, Marjorie, about how the legislature never has the courage to take on police unions on anything. We're going to talk about Baker's reform proposals in a couple of minutes, but this is going to be a big issue for some people.
Well, in fairness, it's a lot of Democrats, Jim, that won't take them on. I mean,
well, they're
I
all
Republicans
Democrats.
Are much more eager.
They're all Democrats.
Well, exactly. Well, that's part of the problem. But I just want to point out that none of the officials at any of the three unions that represent police officers in Boston would comment to the Globe. And Kervin, the officer I mentioned before, the one that was fired, but then his firing was changed to a suspension for reasons we don't know. He was just, according to the police spokesman, he is the head of the Boston Police Superior Officers Federation. And the other guy that they mentioned in the story, who made $325,000 in 2019, was charged 11 years earlier with assaulting his girlfriend while working as a member of the police department's domestic violence unit. The charges were ultimately dismissed, but an internal affairs investigation sustained the charges against him. And he was suspended without pay, but now he's back.
Mm. We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
I don't know, Andrea. I guess it makes me nervous that someone that would be found to have beaten up his girlfriend.
No, he wasn't.
I don't know.
You just said he wasn't found.
Internal
he was charged.
Internal affairs for the Boston Police Department sustained the charges against him.
But what was the ultimate thing? What was the ultimate finding?
He was suspended without pay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you just said that at the end of the...
No.
Oh, my apologies. You want to have a final thought on this,
like
Andrea?
Would you like me to call you back
on?
When you're done?
No, but I
no,
guess,
Marjorie
I guess
is...
in this climate, it's very distressing.
By the way, court records show the charges, Marjorie, it says, unless I'm wrong here, were ultimately dismissed by a judge in that case. Were they not?
That's exactly what I said, Jim. And then I went on to say that the spokesman for the police said an internal affairs investigation by the police sustained the charges.
Right.
and he was suspended without pay. That's exactly right. What I said.
Okay, my apologies. That's okay. Andrea, do you want us to move on? Let's move on.
I dozed off. No, the point that I was going to make on this story is that the conversation, you know, about what's in police union contracts should be about abuses and excesses. It doesn't have to be about taking away anybody's rights to anything, rights that are well settled in the law. It's not about the ability to bargain or any of those kinds of things which are fundamental to every single labor contract. It's identifying the excesses and the abuses in a contract and committing, whether it's the legislature or a municipality, committing to eliminating those.
Can I say one place where I disagree with you? Because as I've said, and then I promise we'll move on, I've negotiated, as I've said repeatedly, when I was a union president, 100-plus collective bargaining agreements. Many of them have very detailed disciplinary proceedings. But I'll give you one example where I assume, Andrew, you would agree that it may have gone too far. There are a number of police contracts around the country that say that an investigator cannot talk to an alleged offending police officer for 48 hours. Which most of us know allows police officers to, quote, get their story straight. And I don't understand why there should be 48 seconds if there's alleged wrongdoing by any employee anywhere, why the employer, as long as the employee is adequately represented, shouldn't be able to speak to the alleged offender in a nanosecond. I assume you agree with that, right?
Oh, you know, certainly I've said before that I agree with it. I think it's one of those provisions that gets built into a contract in a year when the finances aren't sufficient to give the increase they want. But I also think, you know, the idea that that happens, people who commit crimes and even victims of crimes are questioned by the police in the immediate aftermath of those traumatic events, because that's when a person's memory is going to be freshest and you can get the most truthful information. Why that would suddenly, there'd suddenly be an exception to that rule when a police officer is involved in a shooting or some other event where there needs to be an immediate investigation is beyond me. It just doesn't make any sense.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
So, Andrea Cabral, what do you think about the governor's proposal on policing changes?
This particular attempt at reform is really old. People might not realize this, but I remember when I was in the sheriff's department, I remember being approached by, there was a commission, a special commission on sheriffs, and I was representing all the Massachusetts sheriffs on the commission. And I remember that was one of the first times I met David Vieira, who represents, I think, the 3rd Barnstable District. And he was looking for a peace officer standards and training commission to be sort of, I think, reconfigured, because I think it even went further back than when I started talking to him, I think, in 2006, 2008, somewhere around there. And the idea is that there should be basic minimum standards for police officers all across the country, but certainly you can do it within a state, and that there should be a mechanism for assessment and testing and certification or licensure, which is revocable and renewable or reviewable every 3 years. And so I think, you know, what was weird was that it could never get any traction. Commission after commission, and you know, credit to David Vieira, who has stuck with this over the years just relentlessly. And I know Russell Holmes has worked with him on it. They co-sponsored the bill, and they've both been working very hard at it. But it was impossible to get the legislature to sort of follow through because there was pushback from police departments and police unions. Some of it, you know, legitimately concerned about the lack of training even without the post standards and whether or not training would be adequately funded if the post standards were put in place, in which case, you know, that would not inure to the benefit of officers trying to get their certification. But some of it pushback to accountability. So I think I think the reason that Russell Holmes was at the press conference with Governor Baker is that this does seem to be a push toward adopting those peace officer standards and training, and they've added a couple more things into it. And what I'm hoping is that, you know, with a push, additional push by the governor from the executive side, that this really gets turned into law finally, because it's you know, there's just no other way for there to be accountability the way there needs to be. It varies wildly from department to department. There's not even a requirement that all departments report their data, all of which should be public, to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So you consistently see asterisks, you know, in Bureau of Justice Statistics reports that indicate, well, we've only gotten this information from a certain number of municipalities, or provision of this information is purely voluntary. That should not be the case. Everybody should be keeping the data, and it should be reported up to the federal government, which should then report it out.
To say a couple things about yesterday, we broadcast this press availability. And by the way, I would say it was not Russell Holmes joining the governor. I would say it was the governor joining Russell Holmes,
who was
incredible yesterday. And I'm so glad you said that Vieira and Holmes have been at this forever. And finally, it's seeing the light of day because of the horror that befell people like George Floyd. And to the credit of the governor, I think, Andrea and Marjorie, it sounds like he's been meeting with the Black and Latino caucus on these kinds of issues, again, for a while, pre-Floyd. Two things that concern me about it. One, that the governor said yesterday, and at least when we went on the air, the details weren't out yet, that the a lot of this stuff will be public, including the whatever it is where they'll collect the training records and conduct records of officers. And what makes me nervous is that maybe the training records will be available to the public, but what really matters is the conduct records may not be available to the public, which I think really matters. And again, I don't know, maybe it's in there and we'll see. The other thing that drove me over the edge, I meant to say this to you, Marjorie, is the governor said, we hope we have this done in the 45 days left in the session, when he was asked about, well, are you going to urge them to stay if they don't? And he was hesitant. And I have to say, the notion that most of these people have to go home in, what is it, the end of July to campaign, theoretically, in election year they end earlier, in light of the fact that most of them don't have any opponents anyway, and that police reform is not more important than, if they need the time, than an extra week or so without, you know, rubbing the flesh and raising money, it's appalling to me. Stay till you get the damn work done. No?
I agree. I completely agree with you. It really, you know, hewing to, schedules and timelines that might operate fine in normal times, in a time as abnormal and where there's so much need for real, you know, sort of commitment and courage to making these kinds of changes. It doesn't make any sense at all, and particularly not in a state like Massachusetts, where, you know, you rightly point out, the vast majority of people are, elected officials are running unopposed. But if you want to build a better record to run on, then stay and do the work, and you know, take what time you have left, touting the additional achievements you were able to get done by staying a little bit later. But yeah, I don't see, there are very few things more important than this.
You know, Andrea, one thing we haven't talked about at all today on the show, Marjorie and I have not, is this historic indictment of the cop who shot and killed Rayshard Brooks down there. And I have to say, and it allegedly kicked him when he's lying on the ground rather than helping him. I know you may not be an historian as relates to this, but I was lying in bed last night thinking about it. Has there ever been a cop in American history who's been charged with a crime that was potentially punishable by death in terms of something he or she did in the line of duty?
Aside from John Connolly at the FBI, wasn't he charged with murder?
I don't know.
Yes, he was.
He was? Okay.
Yes.
And was
I think Florida
was that a federal
state. But no.
Okay, okay.
I mean, it's the rarity. I mean, your point is the rarity. And even when you said the words historic indictment, I bristled because they were true. Because what you said was true.
Yeah.
And it you know, it angers me tremendously given the what should be in terms of accountability for police violence and police killings. I mean, you just, if we can name, you know, 40 or 50 people, and believe me, there are lots of people of color who can name, I would say at least 20 to 25 people off the top of their heads who you know, are known as people who were shot by police officers, and not be able to name on the other side any level of accountability for people, you know, for those deaths. It's astonishing. It's astonishing. And, you know, that it took people being forced to look at a police officer with his knee on the neck of a man, suffocating him to death for over 8 minutes, for us to even get to this point, and still at this point get the levels of pushback that we get, and still at this point have a senator like Rand Paul stand on the floor of the Senate and presume to lecture Kamala Harris and Cory Booker about why there's no need for a federal lynching law, and still in 2020 know that in the month of May, five black men have been found hanging from trees in public places, which if that were a regular thing, I think we'd have heard about it before, outside of lynching. Just to know that, you know, this is where we still are in 2020 is astonishing. It is astonishing and it is maddening. And if things don't change now, they will not change. And that's why people are staying in the streets. And that's why every single one of us is pushing this, because it's so easy to fall back on not doing anything. And if nothing changes now, it's only going to get worse. But, you know, yeah, the fact that we still have black firsts, that someone is the first black bachelor, and it's touted by ABC everywhere. Isn't this great? It's 2020. We've been here since before democracy.
Hey, I said it was great, too. In the spirit of full disclosure, I'm guilty as charged as well, Andrea.
Yeah, why that is even – the fact that that is a thing – is really in a microcosm of institutional racism. The fact that it is that it, even though it is said is a positive, the fact that it occurs in 2020 and not in, you know, not that the Bachelor was around in 1720 or 1620, but the fact that it takes this long for those things to happen, and people look at people of color as though we should be proud of that achievement versus angry at how long it's taken to get there. That's the disconnect. That's the cognitive dissonance in much of what of the discussions that are happening right now.
Can I say how humiliated I am? May I say that?
You humiliated why? Because you thought it was a good idea?
I thought it was great. I thought it was great that they were finally.
Why did you think it was great?
Because I knew it took too long, but I believe we've discussed this a lot with a lot of people, particularly Sue O'Connell, that cultural change almost has as much meaning, like in the media or something, like the first shows about gay Americans, I think did as much as some of our law changes did, because that's where people spend most of their time. So I thought that was a good thing, even though in defense of myself, I have to say I did agree that it took a little too long, even though there was a bachelor, not the bachelor, in 1780, whatever. So that's my defense.
So can I just ask you this, if we have time, why did you think it took so long for there to be a black male bachelor?
Why did I think? Because
I think there's a lot of racists in America, as we know, and I think that they would have been worried about losing people.
Well, there was a black woman.
Black guy. And I know, but I think that's different.
I agree. I think that's Andrea's different. Question, isn't
White
it?
White women and black men make some people very nervous. Isn't that why? Were they worried about losing sponsors?
Since we don't have time, let's just promise that when we come back next Thursday, I'll tell you why it took so long.
No, I'm going to be nervous for a whole week now. Can you call me after
what
the show
at
least?
What are you nervous about?
I don't know.
Goodbye. Why would you be nervous?
Because I stepped in.
Here's the question, Andrea. Do we all have to watch The Bachelor now? I mean, to check it out?
No, I've not really enjoyed it. You absolutely do not. But there is a historical reason why not portraying a black man as a romantic figure versus a brutish figure driven by sexual need is so long-lasting and so enshrined in television and film that it takes this long to portray someone differently. That's part of the answer, but that's only part of it.
Okay, we'll get the rest. Andrea Cabral, as always, we're really glad to talk to you. Thanks so much. No, we are. Thank you very much. Seriously.
Sorry we went on and on so long about the cops, Andrea, but it just kept me worked up. Andrea Gabriel joins us every week for Law and Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. She's now the CEO of Ascend. Thank you very much, Andrea. Up next, is the United States of America ready to stop fetishizing? Okay. I can't say it. War.
Having a fetish about.
We have a fetish about war in the United States. Are we ready to move
Thank
on?
You.
I'm sorry I botched that. Andrew Bacevich joins us for that conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Regan. It seems America is always at war. We have the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on cancer, even the war on coronavirus, which has given the president the opportunity to declare himself a wartime president. And these are all being fought against the backdrop of the never-ending culture wars. In a recent terrific piece for the New Republic, Andrew Bacevich breaks down how the United States defaults to war, literal and metaphorical, as the expedient solution to a complicated problem, the most recent example being Trump's military response to peaceful protesters across the street from the White House in Lafayette Square. Andrew Bacevich is a professor emeritus of international relations and history at BU's Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and his latest book is American Conservatism, Reclaiming an Intellectual Tradition. Andrew Bacevich, as always, it's a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, too, for joining us, Andrew Bacevich. So, as you put it in one of your pieces, what is it with America and war? What is the deal, this fetish?
Well, I think it has to do with making a fetish of World War II. You know, we're in a moment right now where there's it's kind of a big debate on when does the American story begin. You know, traditionally, it's 1776. Now, there's a strong argument that we should date the beginning from 1619 with the arrival of African-American slaves. And that's a story then that revolves around race. And I'm not going to argue against that, but this is an interpretation of our past. I think there's another interpretation, and that's an interpretation that where the point of origin is World War II, the good war, the war fought by the greatest generation, and a war that, to my mind, has served as a justification, inspiration, legitimizing force in the decades since down to the present moment. And just as there are those who say, hey, we need to rethink the events leading up to 1776 and the role of slavery, I think we need to rethink World War II, which is, to my mind, the source of this making a fetish of war.
We should say, by the way, because I didn't say this in the introduction, the part of the perspective from which Andrew Bacevich comes is you were a colonel in the Army. And by the way, so are you angry at Tom Brokaw, Andrew Bacevich?
No. I'm not angry at anybody, but I do think that that the greatest generation trope, which I kind of get, because both of my parents were World War II veterans, mm-hmm. I think that has impeded our ability to have a clearer understanding of the war. I mean, the simplest things. Who won the war? Oh, we like to think that the greatest generation won the war. But that's an interpretation that requires us to minimize, if not entirely ignore, the role of the Soviet Union. It was the Red Army that killed a heck of a lot more Germans than we did or our English-speaking allies. That seems to me is just one example of the way that we have chosen to sanitize the war. And sanitizing the war then becomes the basis for thinking that war can provide a solution to a host of other problems, as you were recounting in your introduction to our discussion.
Yeah, the war, we have the war on everything, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on cancer. The president has just called himself a wartime when he was interested in the coronavirus, the wartime president fighting the invisible enemy. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily feel them. They're in a battle with their own cancer, but that is what we, the metaphor, I guess, for almost everything. Right?
Yeah, I just don't think it's useful. I don't think that's a basis for conceiving of sound policy. You know, when you think of everything as a war, that distorts the issue at hand. I mean, the war on terror, I think, is an even more vivid example. You know, after the horrific events of 9/11, President Bush declares that we are engaged in a global war on a tactic, and we then find ourselves charging off to Afghanistan, or I should rephrase that, sending our troops charging off to Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, resulting not in the elimination of terror, but resulting in horrendous loss of life, American lives, other lives, spending trillions of dollars in what is an incredibly wrong-headed initiative. But of course, calling it a war in some senses creates an impediment to clearly understanding how wrong-headed that entire policy has been.
Talking to Andrew Bacevich. Andrew Bacevich, you're a signer, along with, I think, at least a thousand other, quote, concerned members of the Long Gray Line, meaning people who went to West Point. It's a letter to the West Point class of 2020. In one section of this really powerful communication, the abhorrent murder of George Floyd has inspired millions to protest police brutality and the persistence of racism. Sadly, the government has threatened to use the army, in which you serve, as a weapon against fellow Americans engaging in these legitimate protests. Worse, military leaders who took the same oath you take today have participated in politically charged events. The majority of the American people in polls I saw, Andrew Bacevich, were unhappy about the president's declaration that he was going to send the military, not only in Lafayette Square, but going to send the military into the states to put down what he considered to be violent protests, which were, in fact, overwhelmingly peaceful protests. I'm not sure that the average American polled objected to that for the same reason you objected to that. Could you explain why you and your colleagues were so concerned about this militarization of an effort to essentially stop fellow Americans from engaging in legitimate protest?
Yeah, I think two things. The first is that that represents a terrible misuse of the American military establishment and of American soldiers. The American military does not exist to enforce domestic order. I mean, one could make an argument that in extreme instances, the Army has played a role, but those are extreme instances. And it distracts from the reality that it's our police forces that are primarily responsible for maintaining law and order. So that was one part of it, is to suggest a misuse of American soldiers. The second part, though, is that stunt that the president conceived, he almost may well have conceived of it almost spontaneously. I'm referring to marching across Lafayette Square and displaying the Bible in front of the church. By involving the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the senior-most officer on active duty, he was crossing a very, very serious red line. He was, in fact, politicizing the American military. And our system of civil military relations, the cornerstone of which is civilian control, assumes that the military will be apolitical. So the president was dragging the military into a deeply controversial moment in partisan politics, and that was extraordinarily dangerous. Now, you're right, you know, people like me, people who signed that letters, we get all excited about this. I think we get excited for good reason. Sadly, I don't think many of our fellow citizens are tuned in to the importance of the civil military tradition that keeps the military apolitical and also keeps the military subordinate to civilian authority. That's a great treasure. And it's something that we need to take care to preserve. The president doesn't care about preserving that. And I think that the rest of us ought to sort of be alert to that.
So, Andrew Bacevich, I saw you on Jim's show last night. You touched on this a little bit. And what did you think that the Joint Chief Miley should have done when the president or whoever gave the order to go to Lafayette Square? What should he have done?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let us note that General Miley, to his credit, has apologized, has acknowledged that he erred. He did that in a speech at the National Defense University. Of course, then his remarks get released. That was necessary, and that was good on his part. Nonetheless, I think in the moment, and there's some indication that he actually didn't know what he was getting dragged into. He ought to have known.
Yep.
But in the moment, he ought to have said, "Sir, I'm not going to participate in this. It is not right for me to participate in this act which you have chosen to do." And he should have refused. Now, maybe he would have gotten fired. And if he'd gotten fired, he'd be celebrated. But he embarrassed himself by participating. And again, it's not so much him embarrassing himself, but he called into question the fact that the military has this tradition of being apolitical. And that was just a terrible thing to do.
So if you are a member of the military and you are given an order that you think is in violation of the Constitution, you can disobey it? I think a lot of people don't think you can.
You can disobey any order you want to. And you suffer the consequences.
Yes.
Okay.
If the order is a legal one, and then you're liable to be punished. You're liable to be court-martialed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could be tossed out of the service. That said, when we're talking about people at the four-star ranks, and let us acknowledge that they are constantly rubbing up against politics as they participate in the process of advising the president to do this or to not do that. I mean, there's no question that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on a daily basis, becomes involved in things that have political aspects. But for that very reason, it's incumbent upon those senior-most military officers to be conscious of the lines that should not be crossed, and quite frankly, to make sure that their civilian bosses are aware of those lines and are aware that they themselves, the senior officers, won't cross them. So, to the extent that Milley knew what he was getting dragged into, and again, there may be some question about that, he should have refused. Mr. President, I will not do this. And then taking the consequences, whatever they happen to be.
We're talking to Andrew Bacevich. He's a professor emeritus at BU and also a former Army career guy. Andrew Bacevich, I was just going to quickly quote something you said last night, which I thought was great, that we're in deep trouble if we have to rely on retired senior military people to, like, take these stands against the president. But a lot of retired and still working military people and the defense secretary have taken a stand against the president. But one of the things I was really wanted to ask you, because you're a student of history, obviously, you've been in the military for all these years. You know, in other countries, if you stand up, like China or Russia or any authoritarian country, if you stand up against the leadership, you're in jail, you're executed, you're in big trouble. In the United States, you're you might lose your job, or you might not be asked to be a commentator on cable news. But it's been stunning, I think, to a lot of people like me, how quickly the military, up until lately, other politicians in the Republican Party, the bureaucracy has knuckled under to President Trump when they're not going to get sent to the gulag. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I mean, so if we're talking about some lieutenant colonel who works in the Pentagon, who basically is a bureaucrat, you know, has some kind of a position where he or she is shuffling staff papers around and preparing briefings, I guess I don't expect that person, you know, to call a reporter from the Washington Post and announce that they are protesting against something that the president said or did. I think it is incumbent upon the senior leadership to police the civil-military relationship in ways that will preserve the core principles of our military system. Maybe it's unfair, but I just don't think that it's the job of the lieutenant colonels to do that. It's the job of the four stars. And again, that's where it seems to me that Milley simply fell down on the job.
By the way, we should say in defense of the general, when you said there's some indication that he didn't know in advance, he says he didn't know in advance. I have no idea if that's true or not.
Yeah, he did.
But in that statement, he said he didn't know. You know, we've spent a lot of this time, Andrew Bacevich, talking about Donald Trump's disregard for the Constitution and the appropriate relationship between a commander-in-chief and the military in this country. But this is not the sole province of one party. I introduced you by saying that, you know, in this country, we tend to default to war both literally and metaphorically. Democrats are pretty good at that, too. Did they get it in 2020? I don't mean in terms of sending troops to put down peaceful protests in the states or across from the White House. But the larger point you're making in your New Republic story, are Democrats that much better at getting this than Donald Trump is?
No. I mean, no. I mean, I think this. I mean, to the extent that we collectively, and I think it's not simply the political establishment. It's our the citizenry. To the extent that we fall for this notion that war, real or metaphorical, provides a solution to some problem that's bothering us. Both parties buy into that. There's absolutely no question about it. You know, I just finished writing a piece that hasn't appeared yet that references Dr. King's famous, rightly famous, sermon in Riverside Church back in 1967, where this was his famous speech coming out against the Vietnam War. In the course of that, he denounced what he called the giant triplets of racism and militarism and extreme materialism. And the point of my piece is to say, okay, looks like we now have at least the first part figured out in the sense that we understand the depth of the problem that racism causes. And there is, some people are not buying into this, but many of our fellow citizens, both political parties, appear intent on finally addressing racism in a serious way. But nobody's addressing militarism. I mean, I am astonished here in 2020, coming up on an election, about the utter neglect of the lack of accountability, the refusal to discuss our military policies for the past 20 years, which have been costly failures, failures in which both parties are implicated, both Democrats and Republicans, and yet there is no accountability. I think that's astonishing, and I think that what that also says is, you know, please God, we're able to deal with the problem of racism in our country. If we think everything's going to be hunky dory after that, I think we're deluded ourselves. We still have those other issues that Dr. King identified back in 1967 staring at us in the face.
And the reason that people, leaders, in quotes, don't address this militarization issue is because for fear that they will be deemed unpatriotic by a public that has the attention span of a gnat. Is that what?
No, that's certainly part of it. You know, I mean, who wants to be the next George McGovern, right?
Yeah.
To be, you know, tarred at being anti-war and therefore anti-military. I think that's part of it. I also think, and here's another hobby horse of mine, the all-volunteer force is partly an explanation. It's easy to go to war, real war here, not metaphorical war. It's easy to go to war when you're sending off somebody else's kids to go fight, when the nation as a whole basically sits on the bench or in the bleachers cheering, and when the nation doesn't even pay the bill. I mean, all we do is keep, you know, running up ever greater debt in order to sustain military policies that are patently unsuccessful. but there's nobody accountable. I think I just read that, I think it was the Senate that just is about to pass a bill for a, whatever it is, $750 billion budget for the Pentagon next year. We talk about defunding police forces. Maybe we should defund the Pentagon. And what I mean by that is at least critically scrutinize what the heck we're getting for all the money that we're shoveling to the Pentagon.
Andrew Bates, but you mentioned a hobby horse of yours.
I just asked if we should have a draft.
Oh, that was my hobby horse, yeah. I mean, Charlie Rangel, as you recall, former congressman from Harlem, every session in Congress would reintroduce a draft, and he would say, it's not really because I want a draft. It's because only if there was a draft would we have serious discussions in these chambers about the consequences of war. Should there be a draft?
Well, my answer to that question is that, well, no, we're never going to get a draft, but why can't we have national service? Why can't we have
you.
A program where everybody serves, country or community, for a period of time, that becomes part of citizenship? That's how you pay your dues, and in return, you are allowed to exercise the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution. So that's somewhat different than a draft, but again, it would require sacrifice. And in the culture today, unless sacrifice is voluntary, that's an exceedingly tough sell.
You know, this was not on our agenda. I'm so glad you brought this national service thing up. Marjorie and I have talked about it before. A couple of weeks ago, I had an opportunity to interview General McChrystal, not about this issue, but because his firm is helping the city, Boston, Mayor Walsh, deal with the coronavirus. And at the end, I said, I know you were chair, and I feel horrible. I can't remember the name of the thing, but a thing that talks about national service. And I said, do you support it being mandatory? And he said, no, essentially. Many years ago, I interviewed Senator Kennedy, as in Ted Kennedy, who supported national service. Do you think it should be mandatory? No. Why is there such reluctance? I understand the anxiety of an elected official to say, I'm going to mandate that your child, your son or daughter, potentially go to war. What is the reluctance of an American politician to say, I want to make sure that your 18-year-old, when he or she graduates from high school, serves his or some or her or some community so they have a better sense of the world and a better sense of their relationship to their country?
Well, it's still a tough sell because the college-bound 18-year-old and that young person's parents, they don't want to be told, well, you're going to have to wait 2 years. You know, Yale beckons. Nope. You got to go do some 2 years of national service. So I think it's one of these things that it will never gain any traction unless it gains traction from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
I think to some degree that's what we are seeing with regard to race right now. All the politicians are up there scrambling to demonstrate how they have seen the light. And I think that to some degree that is a result of the fact that there is a large movement on the part of the American people, all colors, you know, all classes, that basically is saying there must be some change. So it is the grassroots aspect of the current protests, I think, that, at least for me, make them so impressive. And I think it would require some kind of a similar grassroots demand for a change to our so-called all-volunteer military system in favor of a system of national service that would include military service, but other things as well. And, you know, there was a commission on national service that either...
Colin Powell, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, it is going to be dead on arrival, in my estimation, which is, I think, quite regrettable.
I hope you're wrong, but I'll tell you, we really enjoy talking to you, Andrew Basevich. We really, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, and I think some of us could see our children delaying the frat parties for a couple of years, Andrew Basevich, and do a little something for their country.
Well, it's two of us, Marjorie. That's a start.
Anyway,
Andrew, thanks so much for your time.
We
appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Andrew Basevich is a professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University's Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and his latest book, American Conservatism, Reclaiming an Intellectual Tradition. Up next.
Can I just interrupt one second, Marjorie, if I can?
Yes.
People should Google this letter that he and more than 1,000 graduates of West Point wrote to the graduates and juxtapose that with the president. And if you recall, Marjorie, the president, to speak at West Point, the graduates were mandated to quarantine themselves,
right,
come back to graduation and social distance, not be allowed to have families and friends to hear the president give a 30-minute, what essentially was a campaign speech at West Point. So if you read this letter, it is really a powerful and beautiful work.
Well, Andrew Basevich is a powerful writer and speaker as well. Anyway, coming up, we're going to talk to Rick Steves. He's going to tell us about how and why protests against police brutality in America are resonating all around the world. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. When President Trump used military might to stop people from peacefully protesting police brutality, it shocked just about every American, maybe with the exception of Senator Tom Cotton, I guess. When Rick Steves saw the demonstrators in Lafayette Square being tear-gassed and pelted with rubber bullets, he saw an act that wasn't just shocking to him, it was shockingly familiar because it reminded him of tactics used in 1930s Europe when fascism was on the rise. Rick joins us in line to talk about what we can learn from that part of European history. Rick Steves is an author, television and radio host, and the owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30, as you know, right here on GBH2, and his radio show, Travel with Rick Steves, Sundays at 4, right here on 89.7. Rick, wonderful to talk to you, as always.
Thanks, Jim and Marjorie. Nice to be with you.
Good.
Oh, great to talk to you, Rick. And Jim mentioned the parallels you saw between what's going on now and what went on in Europe when fascism was on the rise. You write about this a lot in your blog. You did this whole great documentary about watching the rise of fascism in Europe. So tell people a little bit what you were talking about.
Well, yeah, I've spent a lifetime really taking Americans around Germany, and I think it's so important that we learn from history. It's funny, I got a history degree and I got a business degree. You know, I did my history degree because I love history, and then I thought I need something practical, so I'll get a business degree. And if I look back on that, you know, 40 years later, I find my history degree has been every bit as practical as my business degree. We need to learn from history, and history is speaking to us right now. If we look at what Europe went through, and it wasn't just Germany, half of Europe was fascist back in the 1930s. They had a playbook for these dictators. And when you look at the moves to the far right today, not just in the United States, but in countries all around all around Europe, in Poland and Hungary and Turkey, and you see that there are wannabe dictators that are using the same tactics to derail their democracies. When we think of what happened just recently at Lafayette Square, you know, law and order is a big deal for any fascist leader. Law and order is a rallying cry. Also, stoking a fear of the left. You know, Hitler really rose to power by scaring people about communism or the far left. And today we hear stories of Antifa and, you know, how the far left can derail our country. But it's being used, I think, by the right.
You know, I have to say, Rick, I'm unfortunately, you probably don't listen to our show every day. You may have a few other things to do out there on the West Coast.
But it's a big hit in Seattle, yeah.
We're huge.
But
Sound.
I have to tell you the truth. And up until I watched your film,
I learned a lot.
Every time, not only I learned a lot, but every time a caller calls our show and references Nazism or Mussolini, mm-hmm. I have to say, I usually shut them down, and hopefully not disrespectfully, but say I don't want to hear those parallels. I don't. But I watched your film last night, and almost every couple of minutes, talking about, you know, people like Hitler and Mussolini ascending through democracy, and then all of a sudden, you know, seizing more power through unconstitutional means. The parallels are so constant and so apt. It is. It's amazing to me, which further lends credence to what Marjorie talks about every day on the air when we're talking about the history of Black Americans, is how ignorant so many of are about that piece of our history. And I'm embarrassed to say how ignorant I've been about some of the history of Europe that you tell in this powerful film, Fascism in Europe.
Well, thank you. You know, I really, it's been on my mind for years. And then in the last few years, I just decided I've got to mobilize my crew and get over there, because what I love to do, and thank goodness for public broadcasting, because this is the kind of programming that public broadcasting is all about. Take an important issue that caring, smart, well-educated Americans are steep on the learning curve, and share a perspective on it you can gain from, for instance, from travel. And when we travel, we're exposed to these kind of ideas, and it is just... It's the key of good travel is for the travel to be transformational. And when you travel around Europe, you learn from these monuments. You learn what Europe paid a huge price for a dumbed down electorate. And now I see in our society sort of a subconscious interest in dumbing down our electorate. When I go to Germany, I find a very interesting passion for having a smart electorate. It's not a political thing. It's not a calculation of if the electorate is smart, will they vote our way? It's just more fundamental than partisan politics. We need a smart electorate, or people that want to take advantage of a dumbed down electorate will capitalize on fear and division and you know, charisma and stoking your base and media. And time again, when we are making this show, after we've made the show, my crew and I shake our heads and go, oh, my goodness, the show we made showing about fascism in Europe in the 1930s is more and more and more appropriate to what we're learning from history today. Of course, it's too simplistic to say, you know, Trump and Hitler. I would never say that, but
oh,
I would say we can learn from history. And the more I studied this, Jim and Marjorie, the more I thought I'm thankful to have had a chance to make this. And it just reminds me the value of travel and the value of being engaged as a citizenry, because this is not rocket science. When people want to derail democracy, there's a playbook. And a lot of us think, oh, our democracy is so solid and invincible. But I think democracy is more fragile than we realize. And as citizens, regardless of our politics, we need to be vigilant.
We're talking to Rick Steves, who, amongst his other titles, has written Travel as a Political Act, which obviously makes sense. Now, when you talk about a smart electorate, another thing I learned from your film, Rick Steves, was that every school child in Germany has to visit the site of a concentration camp, which I think is really smart and smartening for young Germans who didn't live through the horrors of the 30s and the 40s.
Right. In fact, as a tour guide, I have an ethic of never taking a group of Americans to Germany without taking them to a concentration camp. And for a lot of people, oh, I'm on vacation. Yeah, I studied that. I don't need to know. No, if you have not been to a concentration camp, you owe it to the victims of the Holocaust to go and personally make a pilgrimage to a concentration camp. And it'll send you through an emotional ringer that may not be enjoyable, but it's part of your education. And just to respect the wishes of the Holocaust that we forgive but never forget. A way to do that is to visit a concentration camp, and I find them to be highlights of any sort of European travel experience.
Well, Rick Steves, before we get beyond the war, I want to go back to the buildup of fascism, and there were some parallels when you talked about how industry in Germany, particularly like the steel industry, you pointed out, backed Hitler for economic reasons. And again, you could see those parallels in the United States, where there are a lot of big industry supporting Trump because of tax cuts.
Profit over principle.
Yeah.
Well, and the fascist leader is just determined to capitalize on those concerns. Mussolini said that fascism could also be called corporatism. It was an alliance between great corporations and the political world of a society. Trump came to office by promising jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, throughout my lifetime, strangely, I think of jobs as almost a four-letter word, because it's used against us to make us not consider bigger issues, issues that are much farther into the future than our quarterly financial situation. And we need to be more sophisticated in our assessment of things. But what a fascist leader does is simplify things and then just tell big lies, tell them over and over and over. Gather together people at big rallies. I mean, Hitler loved his rallies, and that's where he would stoke his base, and people would be chanting these simple solutions. If somebody tells you that the solutions are simpler than what they really are, that person's trying to take advantage of you. And this is a spooky parallel, I would say.
By the way, speaking of simplicity, you've spoken to a lot of students of history in this film Fascism in Europe. Here's I'm going to butcher these names, Francesca Caruso and Andreas Clemens describing how dictators come to power. Here it is.
Starts as violence. I mean, how did fascism start? These were gangs of, in most cases, veterans of the war who went around the streets beating workers up, beating up the socialists. This is how it started.
That's another side. It's not the one I was talking about. We'll get to when, as soon as that's available, the thing about here it is. Here's the sound I was looking for.
People didn't have a choice to accept Mussolini as
that's
their
also
leader.
The wrong sound.
It was
okay.
Against the law.
In any case, in a couple of minutes, we'll play the play the right one. We're talking to Rick Steves.
You did go visit in Nuremberg that Zeppelin field that we've all seen pictures of with thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Tell us about that place.
Well, what was amazing about the Zeppelin field, and by the way, when we were filming the show, you can imagine, for me, it's a challenge to tackle something where it's all history and it's all ruined buildings, or it's all walking through a museum and looking through into glass cases about artifacts. But to walk around Zeppelin field, you remember the propaganda films that Hitler produced. And these were groundbreaking films. And he would gather, hundreds of thousands of people together on this Zeppelin field. And you can walk today in the stands there, and you can look out over the field. And when you think of the insistence that Hitler had on getting people to come to these rallies, and then people who couldn't come to the rallies, the rallies were filmed, and then they were showed in every schoolroom through the country. And then people were given postcards at the rallies, and you had to mail your postcards to all your friends who couldn't have been there. It's just an amazing amount of kind of social media from the 1930s that enabled Hitler to take these rallies and make them permeate society.
So if at first you don't succeed, here is the conversation that Rick had with Caruso and Clemens. Here it is.
When there's great fear of the future, where what people have feels threatened and they're afraid to lose it, then it's easy for populism to come into play, and it's easy for leaders who present themselves as interpreters of that to take hold.
One of the things that you can do to make sure that something like this will not happen here or in other countries is not trust people that promise you very easy answers for very complicated problems. It never works.
By the way, when I was listening to that, the two of them could have been on Anderson Cooper last night saying the exact same thing about current events. Steves, while I learn a lot from you, not just history, it's also embarrassing because on your blog in the last week or so, you've also been integrating a lot of really important art that expresses the feeling of the time, from Goya to Delacroix, if I pronounce it, to Munch. I'm not sure if I pronounce him. But in the film, you also reference Picasso's Guernica, and I assume, I'm guessing, you've seen it in Madrid. I was lucky enough when I was living in New York City in the late 70s. I went to the Museum of Modern Art, where it was for a couple of decades, because I guess the Spanish, am I correct about this, were concerned about its destruction after World War II.
Right.
So it was shipped to New York. Right. At one of the most imposing, powerful, message-laden things I've ever seen in my life. What was it like for you the first time you encountered it?
Well, you know, from my memory, Jim, Guernica was out of Spain at Picasso's wish until the fascist dictator Franco was gone.
Right, I think you're right.
And when Franco died, then Guernica went back to Madrid and got a place of honor there. And to go to Guernica, to me, if there's one piece of art that is the sort of European piece of art, you know, maybe the piece of music would be Beethoven's Ode to Joy, mm-hmm. and Guernica would be one of its sort of iconic pieces of art, because Guernica humanizes war in a powerful way that only Picasso, that goes sort of beyond reality in his cubism and so on, could share. And you see in Guernica a powerful mural, a kind of a collage of what is collateral damage. What is the innocent victim's fallout of an aerial bombardment? And this was Hitler offering his Luftwaffe, his military air force, to Franco to bomb the troublesome Basque people who were standing up for their rights during Spain's civil war. And Franco, the fascist dictator in Spain, said, sure, I'd love some help. And Hitler said, well, great, because I'd like to try these bombs out and see what it's like to pulverize the city from the air. And it was the first aerial bombardment ever. And it was a horrible thing. And it was sort of a little sneak preview of what would be commonplace a few years later in World War II. But Picasso immortalized that with this Guernica. And to be able to see it in its amazing sort of shrine setting in Madrid, but also to go to the town of Guernica, where the bombing took place, and learn from visiting that. It's just a pilgrimage for anybody that wants to learn from history.
By the way, and for those who haven't seen it, it is immense, by the way, in addition to the power of every inch of it.
Rick Steves, your documentary. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying we can learn so much from art. And I've been thinking how, you know, today we share everything with social media. Today, recently with the George Floyd murder and all of the protest in the street, you know, that only happened because a girl had her camera phone ready and was able to video that. Well, a lot of horrible things happened through history where there was no girl with a camera phone standing by to capture it. And it was bold artists that captured this. And it was after the fact because they had to paint it. But there were artists that really went out of their comfort zone, artists that were in the employ of the king, that actually on the side would make powerful art that rose public awareness of things that were going on or of challenges and heroic battles for liberty, equality, fraternity, and so on, that led to these revolutions that helped Europe overcome that old regime notion and establish the idea that, no, we don't have we're not in a world where some are born to be kings and everybody else is born to be rulers, but we're in a world where when we're, when we're developed and when we're a successful civilization, we have democracy and we have freedom. That didn't just happen. And there was a lot of people in the age before television and radio and social media that had to teach each other and inspire each other with their art. And even a century later, two centuries later, we can look at this art and be inspired from it. And that's something I like to do. And that's something I like to share in my work.
Rick Steves, something else I also learned in your documentary, The Story of Fascism in Europe, was the sort of art that was approved during the Nazi regime in Germany with the everybody had to be blonde, blue-eyed.
Tall and fit.
My goodness. You know, all my life I've been fascinated by that because I think art can be abusive. Art can be used as propaganda, and whether it's from the far left or the far right. I mean, communists were really good at using art for propaganda, and so were the fascists. And we went to museums in Germany that had this fascist ideal. Of course, Hitler famously got rid of all of the what he called the degenerate art. And a lot of the greatest art in Europe was just not allowed in Germany during Hitler's time. And he had this feel-good art where everybody looked alike and everybody embraced the flag and everybody marched in lockstep. And, you know, you can effectively use art, whether you're in the Soviet Union or whether you're in fascist Germany in the old days. You can effectively use art to convince most people, most normal people that are not really politicized, that this is the norm, this is the way we have to do it, don't raise your head or you got to get used to seeing your own blood. And art keeps people down, or art inspires people to rise up and be free. But we can learn from that. It's just, you know, Marjorie and Jim, as you're saying, I look at that show even now and I get goosebumps when I think of what's going on in our world, within and without our own country. We've been talking so much about the show, we should remind people that they can see it any time on PBS streaming services or at my Rick Steves website or on YouTube. They can just Google or search for Rick Steves and fascism.
I would
The story
urge
of fascism
people do it.
You know, in Europe.
You mentioned the old days. Can we end for a few minutes, Rick Steves, on the new days and the images, I have to say, when you turn on the television and you see crowds in France and in Amsterdam and other places that are so immense, inspired by George Floyd, but also not just about what's happening across the ocean, but in their own communities. Talk for a few minutes about your reflections on the protests that are, in some ways, as big and powerful there as they are here.
You know, these protests in the United States, to me, they're striking because I've been thinking the United States is pulling back from the rest of the world. And in a lot of ways, we are. Mm-hmm. But these protests are such an inspiration overseas. And it reminds me that the ideals of America are bigger than any one political moment. They're bigger than any one party or politician or scandal or whatever. The ideals that people respect and are inspired by that are America are still shiny on a hill. And when I travel around Europe these days and people always ask me, what's going on in your country politically and so on? My European friends, we can squabble about this or that approach to how we tax people and how we provide social services and what kind of benefits we have and how long's your work week and how much paid vacation do you get and what about healthcare and who pays for the education. There's all those issues that Europe's struggling and we're struggling with. But one thing Europe is really learning right now is they need American leadership. They want American leadership. And right now, under a banner of Make America Great Again and America First, what the world is finding is there is no more American leadership, and they lament that. They know that somebody needs to provide leadership in this gaggle of nations on this planet, and the United States is uniquely equipped and able to do that, and it deals not just with our size and our economic might, but with our passion for these ideals that do make America great. And that's something that's coming out of these demonstrations right now, is that the world is once again being inspired by America, I think.
Well, as Jim just said, and you said too, there are significant racism problems in a lot of Europe too. And I haven't been that many places. I'm hoping to improve that in my old age. But when I did go to Paris a few years ago, because one of my kids was over there for the junior year thing, and I was surprised to see military policemen with high-powered assault rifles standing in front of synagogues, in front of Jewish churches, in front of museums. Now, this was after the attack against the cartoonist that drew the pictures of Muhammad, and there was the slaughter at that magazine. But I was surprised to see that show of military force like that on the streets of Paris. Is that unusual, or does that happen there and elsewhere?
Well, you know, we have a challenge in our society of a militarized police force. And in Europe, what you have is a situation where Europe is sort of the standard bearer of diversity and the standard bearer of, speaking out on things that might anger terrorists. Europe is full of soft targets. Europe is just a playground for terrorists who might want to wreak havoc. And Europe refuses, as a matter of principle, to be locked down. So we have Europe that endures terrorist events time after time, and we have Europe that wants to keep things open. But at the same time, Europe needs to have a very high profile for its security forces when it comes to terrorist targets. So when you travel around Europe today, you go to the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi, you go to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, you go to any synagogue anywhere, you will find high-profile military police. And I counsel my travelers when they're preparing for their trip that's something that shouldn't be frightening to you. That's something that should be reassuring to you. Europe has these military forces in their barricades and they decide in their stations and in their camps, and they just decided, let's put them on the streets to have a more high profile for security against terrorism. So I see that as a societal statement that we're not going to be terrorized by the terrorists and our lives are going to go on. And I see that as a good thing.
Rick, thanks for the tutorial, as always.
I liked your tour of the catacombs. I don't know if you're aware, that was on last night right here, or the night before. Last night or the night before, the tour of the catacombs, a section on stuff on Rome, which was fantastic. So we're big fans Rick. Big fans.
Thanks. Well, it's so much fun to share my ideas and some of these travel ideas and tie them into what's going on in our country and with all of us during these challenging times. And I look forward to our next conversation.
So do we.
Yeah.
So do we. Be
absolutely.
Well, Rick.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rick. Rick,
hey, happy
Steve.
Travels, even if you're just staying home.
That's right. Rick Steves joins us every month. He's an author, television, radio host, the owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30 right here on WGBH2. And it's so soothing. That's one of the things I love about it. You learn so much and it's so soothing. Travel with Rick Steves is at Sundays, 4 o'clock, also right here on 89.7 WGBH. Thank you so much again, Rick, for joining us.
Coming up in a minute or two is the Attorney General of the Commonwealth. Maura Healey is going to comment on the Supreme Court decision this morning, rejecting the administration's position on Dreamers, the DACA program. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In a minute or two, Attorney General Maura Healey is going to give us a buzz to talk about the Supreme Court's decision this morning blocking Donald Trump from ending the DACA program, which I have to say, another one I was surprised by. But we'll talk to the Attorney General about that in a couple of minutes. We apparently have lost Marjorie. What I was going to talk to Marjorie about, I'll talk to you listeners about as we wait for the Attorney General. At the end of our conversation with Andrew Bacevich, who former Army colonel. And as I said, he mentioned at the end there civilian service, and he said it might include, if it's a draft, military service too. But I have to say, I think it would change this country in such a wonderful way, and I agree with him, a lot of parents would be upset, your kid's on their way to Yale, your kid's on your way to a great job, whatever it is. If every high school kid in this country, Marjorie, was required 1 year, they get a stipend, like a city year kind of thing from the federal government or whatever, to serve, I would preferably say not your own community, but another community, to learn about people who are not like you, to learn about what service is like. And again, your kid is not put at risk of physical harm in the way that you worry he or she might be if they go into the military, if there's a military draft. Would this not be a world-changing, positive kind of thing?
I think it'd be fantastic. And I think that the that the mandated thing is the way we should go, because otherwise it'll never happen. And I think it would change everything. And I think that we're asked to do next to nothing for our country. You know, in the words of Jack Kennedy a million years ago, you know, why don't you ask what you can do for your country for a change? Well, we don't even pay attention, half of us, to what's going on. So I think it would be a great thing.
We don't even vote, half of us.
I know. I know. So I think, you know, also for people that are looking for it would be great for wealthy kids, middle-class kids, poor kids, everybody kind of in a mix of people. I think they should go someplace beside their own community, and I think it'd be terrific.
Well,
your kid did City Year.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, my kid did AmeriCorps. I know a lot of people that did City Year that thought it was a life-changing experience.
Which is a voluntary thing, as you say, proving that voluntary doesn't work because a very small number of people decide they want to do it. And I'm not celebrating them above others. That's the choice they make, and there's no mandate to do it. But again, let an 18-year-old... But essentially, an enforced gap year before they go to work, before they go to college, before they go to community college, whatever. I would love a high-profile leader who is not risk-averse to not just champion the notion of national service, and a lot of people do that, but of mandatory national service. I would love the idea. And as I said, if people weren't listening a few minutes ago, a lot of people think symbolically that mandating military service, or at least talking about it in Congress, as I mentioned, Charlie Rangel, the longtime congressman from Harlem, used to file a bill every year knowing it would go everywhere, and he was just, and nowhere. He just wanted to make the point that if we were worried that our kids were the ones who were going to have to go to war, then America and the people who represent us would take war and the military far more seriously than we do now, which we, for the most part, don't do at all. The only time we even hear of Congress talking about most of these things is when there's an appropriation bill coming up. We're waiting for the Attorney General. She's going to join us in a couple of minutes, or I think any minute, to talk about her reaction to this. Oh, as a matter of fact, she's joining us now, the Attorney General of the Commonwealth, Maura Healey. Attorney General, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be with you guys. Yeah, good day.
Yes, it is.
Exactly. So tell us what the Supreme Court has done.
Well, you know, basically what the Supreme Court did is rule in favor in a case that we brought along with other states that challenged Donald Trump and his decision to shut down the DACA program. And, you know, we know that DACA has been one of the most successful programs out there in this space, and that there are thousands and thousands of Dreamers here in Massachusetts who, you know, their entire livelihoods have been put at risk as a result of what the president did. So we took them to court. We won. Justice Roberts authored a 5-4 decision today that struck down the president's actions. And so the DACA program lives to see another day. And that's great news for Dreamers here in Massachusetts and all across this country. And you know, I'm proud of the legal work by my office. I'm proud of all the immigrant advocacy organizations who join in support. I can't tell you, you know, this is personal to me. I have talked with, including this morning, Dreamers. We know that these are young people who are doing everything right. They're in school. They're starting businesses. They're serving in our military. They're paying taxes. You know, for many of them, America is the only country they've ever called home. They came here, you know, as infants. They came here as toddlers. Some came later. But, you know, it just is, when I think about all the actions of the president, there have been so many that have been illegal and just wrong as a matter of policy. These are actions, though, you know, that also many times we've seen as cruel. And to see the court rule as it did today, it restores my faith in what's possible, and I'm just glad that you know, we have a system where there is a rule of law, that it still applies, and that no one, including Donald Trump as president, is above it.
Well, unfortunately, though, Clarence Thomas won't be having lunch with John Roberts anytime soon, probably. You know, we should make – I'm so glad you made the point. We all assume Attorney General – everybody knows what the DACA program is. But the most important thing you said, beyond the fact that they're just like – that's the kid sitting next to our kid in the classroom who grew up here, just they didn't come here voluntarily. We can have a debate another day, which we've had, about adults who choose to come to this country. These are kids who were brought here by a guardian, a family member, through no intention of their own. And then they're raised. They're just as American as a kid who is born in this country. The thing that makes me nervous, I haven't read the decision. I've just read summaries of it because we were on the air half hour after they issued it. But the language that Roberts – did Roberts write the majority opinion, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. So Roberts said something like the administration failed to provide adequate justification, which reads to me as if he's not saying the majority is not saying they can never end this program, but they can only end this program if they do provide adequate justification, which basically means they can have another bite at the – well, they may not have one before Election Day, but – if Trump were to be reelected, obviously he could try it again, right?
You know, yes, in theory, yes. To me, this is about vote counts. I think that there may well have been four justices who might have been ready to say that what Trump did was motivated by xenophobia and racial animus.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they couldn't get the chief there. And, you know, instead, the holding strikes down Trump's actions as illegal because they violated the way you're supposed to go about making rules. It was a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. They ruled it arbitrary and capricious. And so, yes, he said, you know, might you have done it another way, it might pass muster. But we know, you know, Jim and Marjorie, we know from the extensive review and investigation we did in our case, we know that there is no legitimate justification for what Donald Trump did. This was just another act of cruelty, of xenophobia, of an administration that seems to think that the more I can put people down, the bigger, the stronger, the tougher, the more powerful I am. And it just is really heartening to me today. You know, and Jim, to your point, you know, there are people who are working in my office, who are working in state and local government, who are working in schools, who are dreamers. Who are dreamers. And these are the people that Donald Trump wanted to boot out. It makes sense only in the spirit of this is a man who is motivated by all sorts of, you know, really insidious things. So I guess it makes sense in that respect. But it made no sense to see what they did with DACA. And I have to tell you, I am so happy. I called a couple dreamers who are close to me this morning when I heard the news, and you know, to hear the joy in their voices and their families, it just meant everything. I called Ava Malona, who is the head of MIRA, the Massachusetts Immigrant Refugees Association, and just this means a lot. You know, this is about people. You know, these aren't just policies on a page. These are about people, just like Monday's decision, right? Another win for us
with Roberts as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And
well, that's what I was going to,
Gorsuch, this is important because we've said all along, you know, and I said, you know, when he does something unconstitutional or illegal, we'll see him in court. And I'm proud of the wins that we've had in court, holding the line on many, many fronts. But I have to say it's cases like these that I find really satisfying because, you know, this is about people, you know, and to deny healthcare, to deny protection in the workplace for somebody just because of their gender identity or sexual orientation, that's not who we are, you know? And so it's really heartening, especially given that last Friday, as I was standing at the State House with Speaker DeLeo and Senate President Spilka and Senator Sear and others to raise the pride flag, right? You know, we have Secretary Alex Azar in town from HHS, and they've come out with that ruling that they're going to rescind protections for transgender people in healthcare, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to, so it was really nice to then have the Supreme Court answer on Monday with this ruling that protects transgender people. And I've also made it clear that, you know, we'll be taking the administration to court over that rescission. But, you know, I'm glad we have the law. I'm glad we have the venue of the courts. And I'm glad that we have a way to try to help people and give them the justice and the security that they need in this time, and to affirm for people that, you know, regardless of what this guy is doing down in D.C., we're your government too. We're your government too.
And congratulations, Attorney General.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
Your
yeah,
calling
thank
in.
You. And we're very glad we can elaborate on this, because you're going to be back with us on Tuesday for an entire hour from noon to 1. So we
yep.
can,
oh,
we
I
can
am.
Continue.
Yeah,
with, yes.
Oh, I am.
Well, in case
let
you didn't
me.
Know, I thought I'd let you know.
Please show up.
I'm sure I knew that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure
thank
did.
You. Hopefully we'll have some more good news before then. We'll see.
Great. Good to talk to you, Attorney
thank
General.
Thank you so
thanks.
Much.
Take care.
That was Attorney General Maura Healey talking about the Supreme Court decision to say that the president cannot at least immediately enforce the DACA restriction, and it's going to take several months before he can get back to the lower court and start again. So it may be, if he is not reelected, this will not be certainly an issue if somebody else is elected. Anyway, coming up, literary agents have a message to all of you aspiring writers out there. Please, please. Stop sending your coronavirus novels, your novel coronavirus novels. Ask me who's here for that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the line is Alex Beam. And every time he joins us, that is, we marvel that his name is Alex Beam, because Alex is writing... Not unlike the Alexander Graham Bell telephone is ring-a-ding. Alex, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for that. Thank you. It's a little delayed, but
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So Alex Beam, as I said when I was introducing you, apparently literary agents across America are being buried in people's novel coronavirus novels, and it's not a good scene.
Yeah, that was a hilarious. I actually heard that when it ran on public radio.
So
they rounded up a couple of. It was much funnier live. They got these literary agents who basically said, "We know what you've been doing in Brooklyn. You know, you've been writing 100,000 words. You think they're good? Don't push the send button. We don't want your novel. We don't." It was really depressing in a way. If you're 28 years old, which I'm not. Because it was these voices of authority saying, you know, don't bother. Albert Camus did it better. You're not Camus. You know, we don't want dreary novels about how bleeping unhappy you've been for 6 months, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it just was a stake in the heart of an entire literary generation.
Well, my favorite line was from someone, I think it might have been the host, Rachel Martin, who said, future Austins and Tolstoys, remember, Rome wasn't built in a day, and War and Peace wasn't written after a few weeks in quarantine. So I absolutely love that. I mean, you know, apparently they were barely crossing the T's before they sent in their manuscripts without revision,
yeah.
Alex.
Although I remember the days. I remember, like, when Charles Stewart went off the bridge and stuff, people used to fax 17-page treatments, you know, to literary. So there always is a kind of a market for the so-called topical book, blah, blah, blah.
Not you, Alex Beam.
Not for me, no.
So, Alex.
No, absolutely not.
Alex, you, in a recent column, which Marjorie and I both liked, to the Better Angels Had Better Show Up in November.
We loved it.
You were obviously quoting from the man who I think most of us would agree is the second greatest president on issues of race. That, of course, would be Abraham Lincoln. Tell us what your column was about.
Oh, yeah, well, I don't want to embarrass you, but I actually got the idea for that column sitting in your studio on the air.
No.
And Marjorie, of all people, in 2016, quoted Deval Patrick as saying that America was, quote, a better angels kind of nation. I mean,
don't
so,
remind me.
Lest you think I'm not listening to you.
Well, that's good.
And, yeah.
And I was kind of, so that, you know, remember, this was in March of 2016. So, you know, Trump was the favorite in the Republican primary, but anyway, so I kind of reeled off this column. I recognized the Better Angels phrase, obviously, from Lincoln's inaugural. And I ripped off this column saying Trump will never be president, because I kind of bought into what Marjorie channeling Deval Patrick was saying, that we're simply too good for this. In fact, I mean, I heard Attorney General Healey's, those were practically her last words in the preceding segment, about the kind of country we are. And anyway, this has caused a lot of soul searching for me individually, because I write this piece about how we're just better than the kind of people that would elect Donald Trump. Then we elect Donald Trump. And so I actually was kind of hard up for a column idea, and I thought, well, you know, I don't mind revisiting this because I was so spectacularly wrong in March of 2016. And when I wrote the column you're talking about, it ran a week or so ago in the Globe, it's just a different me. I know we'd like to think that this situation won't go on, but as you can see, there's a kind of weird note of dark pessimism in the 2020 version of the piece, and it really lives with me, and I'm happy to discuss it.
Now, I'm really disappointed in both of you. When I introduced this column by Alex, I mentioned that he borrowed this from Lincoln. I didn't know the backstory about Deval Patrick and you, Marjorie, the second greatest president in a race, and I was obviously referencing, I thought I'd get a rise out of both of you, the incredible line from Trump in that Fox News industry interview last week or something. I think I've done more for the black community than any other president. And let's take a pass on Abraham Lincoln, because he did good, although it's always questionable, you know. In other words, the end result. What in the hell is he talking about, Alex?
Oh, my God. I have never heard that quote.
That was Fox.
I didn't pick up on it because I assumed you meant Obama as being the greatest president.
No, I meant Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, that's just madness.
I wasn't sure what you were talking about there, Jim.
And you didn't want to embarrass me by asking? Is that what it was?
I guess so.
I don't know. I mean, it's you know, a lot of that has come out in the Bolton frouhaha. I mean, I don't even want to dignify his terrible ignorance with a comment, you know. I mean, to compare himself to Lincoln, I mean, it's like he really will be on the ash heap of history. We can only hope.
But, you know,
this time, though,
I think you have to hope that there are, I mean, I get why people voted for Donald Trump the first time around, even though I was never a fan of his. I get it. Hillary Clinton was a tough candidate. He ran as a populist, as I've said a million times. He's governed as an oligarch and really as an incompetent. But this time around, boy, I think it. What's your excuse this time? I don't know.
Well, can I? You know, Marjorie, if I may answer that rather than Alex, you've said about a thousand times. You've said about a thousand times, and I've agreed with you almost all these times since 2016. You know, he ran as a populist. He fooled people, etc. I'm going to read from Alex's fine column, which I should have been my answer to you. During the 2016 campaign, Trump never hid his true nature, ridiculing people with handicaps, trashing immigrants, and airing extra legal solutions to thwart his opponents, e.g. vowing to lock up Hillary Clinton. So at the same time that people were buying the faux populism, they're buying racism, they're buying his anti-disabled people rhetoric, they're buying locking up his opponents. So it wasn't, I mean, there was more to, he was the birther in chief. There was more to it than just the populism, right?
He was, but I think that, you know, we foolishly thought that he might act as the president when he became president. And there was never anybody less popular running for president besides Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton was the second most hated person ever to run for president.
That's true.
You know what I didn't, you know, 600 words is not a lot. And I mean, I think what I couldn't say in this piece, and it's only kind of maybe intimated, maybe not, is that I felt like that the kind of evil chord that Trump appeals to is inside of me, you know, and I didn't want to admit that, but you can use whatever stupid metaphor you want, but I mean, like a devil sitting on your shoulder, but there are a lot of gateways into people's negativity, anger, and resentment, and I feel like Trump is just a genius, you know, at finding the way in. I don't even know if it made the column, but this idea, these doubts about Biden, you know, he's gonna amplify these messages, and he's appealing to people's worst instincts is something he's very, very good at, and it's very naive to think that even people as enlightened as, like, me don't have bad instincts, because we do.
By the way, the other thing you apparently didn't have room for in your column is to credit Marjorie with the idea for your column.
Well, life's short.
Deval Patrick, I suppose. Would
well,
have
and the governor.
Too.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
We're talking to Alex Bean.
Credit was due. Mr. Lincoln got the credit he deserved.
Yes.
But it is interesting when you do talk to Deval Patrick. You had him on your radio, a TV show this week, and we had him on the radio. There is a real better angels quality to listening to Deval Patrick. You do feel like the better angels are landing on your shoulders when you listen to him talk. And it's too bad he didn't start earlier.
Can I tell you something? I don't know if we've ever said this on the air. I think we did. That last comment you made, I would argue that had his wife not gotten sick, which postponed his entry, and he entered at the time everybody else did, there may have been a different outcome. There may have been a different outcome. So
maybe. I'll just say for the record that the only Deval Patrick I really ever knew was the hour-long Deval Patrick on your show, and he was very impressive. I thought he was much more impressive on your show in some ways. But let's move on.
Let's move on.
Okay,
thank you.
Let's move on to something. This is something I had never heard of. What is a cemetery wedding?
Oh, nor had I.
To end the Spanish flu.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. Well, you're supposed to know, Alex.
No, I actually do know, but I mean, it's like I'm in some kind of trance. The New York Times ran a long, incredibly fascinating article about a Jewish ritual practice that they found a clip from the New York World in 1918 describing. And I don't have the piece in front of me, although I remember it pretty clearly, but I don't know if it's, in a sense, mainstream Judaism, and it might not be. But in any case, there's this ritual called, I think it's called the Schwarze Kahane, which means a dark wedding. And the way you end a plague or a scourge or an affliction, and this was the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, is you have two pure people. Now, I think any man or woman who gets married, I think is given the benefit of the doubt as to purity. You have two
Absolutely.
Pure people who marry in the presence of the dead. In other words, they marry in a cemetery.
Yeah.
And the Times found this astonishing article from 1918, and they did a lot of research. And I guess there have been, three of these ceremonies during COVID? That's the part I don't remember that clearly. In other words,
Hold
that I
on.
Think people have noticed this and are trying to end the coronavirus pandemic.
By having a cemetery wedding?
Having a cemetery wedding. Anyway, then the Times went on in this piece, of course, to note somewhat drolly that you couldn't exactly make a connection between the Schwarze Kahane and the end of the Spanish flu.
No, Alex, you just Marjorie hates when I turn everything into a topic about Donald Trump, but you just mentioned the Spanish. This happened during the Spanish flu of 1918. Do you have a thesis, Marjorie does, on why Donald Trump insists on calling it the Spanish flu of 1917?
I literally do not have a thesis, but I would be interested to hear one.
Well, Marjorie, why don't you share? Because I agree with Marjorie's analysis.
Well, the last time I heard him reference it, he called it the 1918 Spanish
yes, he did.
Flu because he doesn't like to admit he made a mistake.
Right.
So
see, that's what
now.
That was your original thesis, right?
Yes.
That when they corrected him, he knew he had been wrong, but he can't admit that he got it wrong. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. So he had to use it. It was spanned over 2 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
the paper said 2,000 people cheered on the couple. I wasn't clear if they were actually there in the cemetery with them.
No, actually, you didn't read it carefully. The 2,000 dead people cheered them on at the... That's what they were...
Thanks for pointing that out.
No, Marjorie didn't read it closely enough, obviously.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not true, Jim.
If I needed to get married, I'd get married in a Jewish cemetery right now if I could stop the pandemic. So, but I'm not in the need of being married right now.
All right, enough of this. We got to go on to, as time is short here. What is your, tell us briefly, what is the explainer, the Alex Beam 45-second explainer about today, please? What is it?
Well, I'm going to need a lot more than 45 seconds. I'm just joking. No. We're going to explain the incredible threat that has surfaced off of Hingham like a German U-boat, which is the lion's mane jellyfish.
Oh, I am so psyched for this, by the way. Can people back in Brighton start the clock? Give them 55 seconds because I'm interested in the topic rather than 45. Take it away, Alex. Go.
Fine. We're about to know everything I know about the lion's mane jellyfish. In any case, the The harbor master in Hingham was quoted in the Boston Globe, and there have been warnings posted around Hingham out there.
Hingham.
Well, you know, avoid the lion's mane jellyfish. Not its first appearance in our waters, by the way. So we wonder, what is it? It is the largest jellyfish known to man. It's sometimes called the great or the hare jellyfish.
Ooh.
It can have a diameter of 7 feet, although the one off of Hingham has a diameter of 2 feet. It can. Its tentacles, which come in two sets, inner and outer tentacles, have sometimes measured 120 feet in length. I have a few more things. You can't blow the horn.
No, keep going.
Wikipedia points out that the lion's mane jellyfish appears in boreal waters, which means super cold waters, but it has appeared off Massachusetts in the past. Two more very important points. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote a Sherlock Holmes story called The Adventure of the Lion's Mane, which we all need to read. It's very complicated, and it involves the jellyfish. And lastly, listeners want to know, what happens if I'm stung by a lion's mane jellyfish?
What's the answer?
You're going to hurt. It's going to hurt you. Okay. You're not going to die. It's going to sting. You'll have a rash. Rub it with vinegar. You'll be okay. Ignore that story about Rye, New Hampshire, where people died panicking and drowned after they were stung by lion's mane jellyfish.
Okay,
I'm sure that's fake news.
We only have 15 seconds. Thank you. I was not listening to the whole thing, but did you mention, I think I heard on NPR the other day, that the lion's mane jellyfish does not have a brain? Do you know that?
I don't know that. I'm really sorry.
Can you check it out
no
for next week?
Of that.
What?
Yeah, we'll revisit it next week.
Thank you.
We'll
Alex, that was
week,
excellent.
Gaspin.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I loved your Better
cool,
Angels
you
column. I have my fingers crossed for the Better Angels this time around. Anyway, we are done. Thank you very much for listening. You can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow we have our Friday All-Stars, Callie Crossley, Sue O'Connell, and Emily Rooney. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. What's on TV, Jim?
Well, we've had her on the radio. I haven't had her on TV. Dr. Daniela Lamas from Brigham Women's, who is a brilliant writer and a pretty great talker, too. Her most recent piece in the New York Times, I'm a critical care doctor. I'm tired. I'm mourning. I'm bracing for more. We're going to talk about the second wave. Adam Riley is going to talk about the police reforms of the governor. And, you know, far more black lives have been affected in a negative way above the ones we talk about. Recently, Darryl Jones was with me after he was released after having spent 32 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. We're going to play that to remind people there are other injustices that need attention, too. That's tonight at 7. I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thanks so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.
See ya.